Good Friday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming to you from CPAC 2016 at the National Harbor, the Gaylord Convention Center, our on-location sponsor, AdCorps Defense, a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And, of course, it's how you like to start out each and every edition of NRA News Cam and Company. Glad that you are with us. You are watching live inside the ballroom at CPAC 2016. John Kasich and Sean Hannity in a Q&A session. And we have with us on our set all hour long our friend Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. How are you, sir?
I am doing well. Thanks for having me on today.
Absolutely. Oh, and officially now, it's not just Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. It is Ed Morrissey from Hot Air, the author of the brand new book, Going Red, The 2 Million Voters Who Will Elect the Next President. Darn it, you moved it. And How Conservatives Can Win Them. I don't know the subtitle by heart, Ed.
Well, no, my camera was going, hold up the book, hold up the book. Because I am still learning book promotion 101. I was joking around about this with you guys the other day. I said, you know, the other day I was down here and I had the book down here. By the time I get to you guys, it's going to be all the way up to the chin like this.
You need to be able to figure out a way to put that on your lanyard. And walk around with it, right?
I need a sandwich
this
board.
This is my media pass right here.
I need a sandwich board, you know. Going red, the credits on the back. Yeah.
So this is not a Bernie Sanders biography.
It is not. It is not the tragic tale of my short career as a matador. We're coming up with all sorts of different alternative uses for the title Going Red, but this is a story about how Republicans failed to win presidential elections in 2008 and 2012. In places where they had been dominating politics, sometimes for decades. For instance, Virginia. Mm-hmm. I think you're slightly familiar with Virginia.
A little bit. Lived here since 2004.
So you have a passing familiarity with Virginia. Until 2008, the only Republican from really, I think, from before World War II to 2008, the only Democrat that Virginia went for during those years was Lyndon Johnson. In fact, it was an unusual state as part of the South, because a lot of the South didn't come to the Republican, didn't become, you know, deeply Republican until the 60s and the 70s.
Right.
And the 1980s in some cases. But Virginia got there early, and they were a red state for a very long time, and then in 2008 they flipped. A lot of the flip was in Northern Virginia, which you know is a very unusual part of the state. It's very different from what's called the rest of Virginia, or Rova.
Right.
There's Nova and there's Rova. And Rova is red, and Nova, not so much. And so Republicans didn't really understand those differences. They didn't understand the differences. You know, I focus on Prince William County for the Virginia part, for the Virginia part of this. There's one county in each of these seven swing states that I focus on as a bellwether, as an indicator, as a way to tell the story of the entire swing state, plus sort of swing states in general. In Prince William County, there's differences between the western part and the eastern part, and there's differences within the communities that make up Prince William County. And the problem is that Republicans didn't know any of this, and so they would run the same ads all throughout Virginia that they were running in, say, New Hampshire and Pennsylvania. And so they went into these contests with a national message and never really focused on who these communities are, who these swing states were, who these swing counties were. And so voters there felt lectured to. And the difference was that in 2008 and 2012, Barack Obama had the kind of organization on the ground that did know the differences, that understood that, you know, this particular precinct over here is heavy into environmental issues. A lot of people are saying environmental issues are an issue. So they would send out precinct captains, you know, saying, you know, EPA, Obama really wants to fix this, whatever this particular environmental issue was for that community. And, you know, Republicans just want to defund the EPA. But we know we need to fix this one particular problem, and Obama's going to use the EPA wisely to do that, just as an example.
Right.
Not necessarily for Prince William County, but perhaps more for, say, Jefferson County, where in Colorado, even the Republicans tend to be conservationists.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're going to Jefferson County and say, environmentalist wackos are all crazy, we need to defund the EPA, that's not necessarily a winning message in Jefferson County. But if you talk about conservative conservationism, and in this particular case, and there's an opening here in 2016, if you talk about the way that the EPA screwed up the Animas River by opening up that sequestered water in those mines, and talk about how incompetent it was and how that sort of thing should have been left to Colorado because Colorado knew how to manage it. That's a winning message, but you have to know what the issues are, and you have to understand how those communities feel about those issues. And Republicans didn't do a very good job of that. So I went to each of these communities. I talked to people who've been elected in these communities, who have been elected in districts and precincts that didn't go Republican in these presidential elections, found out that they weren't really talking to the same people. The presidential campaigns didn't really talk to the local people. They kind of brought in their own idea of what would sell in Jefferson County or Prince William County or Hillsborough County, Florida, or Hillsborough County, New Hampshire, because there's two Hillsborough counties that are in this book. I hope that's not going to be too confusing for people. But those are the types of things that you have to know. And so elections are won at a local level, regardless of what it is. Scott Walker told me for the book, he says, when you're running for president, you're not really running for president. You're running for governor in about 12 states. I'd argue that what Barack Obama did was he ran for Congress in 435 districts, and that's the reason why he won.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. I'm fascinated about the ideas contained in this book. So are we doing better? Obviously, if we were doing great, you probably wouldn't have found the need to write this book because there'd be no need to point out this stuff, right? But are we making adjustments?
I would say, first off, I think there's been improvement. The RNC has certainly recognized this issue, and the RNC has built an organization for the ground game that removes that task from the candidate. That doesn't mean that the candidate doesn't do anything. The candidate has to be able to use this organization that the RNC is building, but the candidate doesn't have to build it for himself from the ground up the way Barack Obama did in 2008. And then again, he had that organization in 2012, so he was able to have that. He was able to make that work again for him, even though he was not as popular, and even though voters were more skeptical about Barack Obama the second time around, they had that emotional connection based on the fact that he'd really learned to talk their language the first time around, and that emotional connection was enough to keep those voters in his fold in good enough numbers, even though fewer numbers, 4 million fewer votes, remember, for Barack Obama in 2012, to win a national election. So, yeah, the RNC has learned this, and this is one of the, it's not a secret, because people have reported on this. Selena Zito, I know that you know Selena.
Oh, yeah.
She's reported on this, and in fact, I interviewed her for the book specifically for this purpose. They've been out testing this, and people think it's this big data thing. Data's part of it, but they're actually identifying precinct captains, or they're getting them to hold block parties. You know, they just buy some pizza, get everybody together, find out what their issues are. Let us know what their issues are so we can come out and figure out how we can address them. That's the type of thing that Barack Obama did. The Democrats actually didn't build that. Barack Obama built that. And with Obama retiring from the field, there's a large question as to how much of his organization is going to be absorbed into presumably Hillary Clinton's organization, right? But the DNC isn't doing this kind of work that anybody can really tell. So Hillary Clinton's got the resources to do it. Whether or not she's got the talent and whether or not she's made it a priority is another matter. And the people I talked to in some of these, including in one case, a Democratic operative who preferred not to be named, which was actually a really fun conversation. He was a really fun person. Didn't see a whole lot of evidence that they were pulling together that type of organization on the Democratic side.
Interesting. So this is, and it's not about you go away from your principles. It's about how do you market your principles?
Exactly.
How do you get your message out there, right?
Yeah, that's a great point, Cam. And I want to emphasize this because one of the things I talk about in here is that you have to expand the Republican brand and the conservative brand. You can't just keep talking to the same people over and over again. You have to talk to African-American communities. You have to talk because the conservative message will resonate there. Some of it will and some of it won't, but some of it will. Latino communities, millennials, especially millennials. Mm-hmm. We're getting the GOP is getting to be kind of an old party. They need to grand old party, sort of the old is getting underscored. We need to find ways to attract younger talent into the field. And you do that by going and asking people, what matters to you? Not, well, here we are, come be like us.
Yeah.
Right? Come be a clone of whatever it is that we think should be. And you know who actually put this best, and she's her voice is very strong in this book, is Sonny Johnson. Breitbart.
Okay.
You know Sonny.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And Sonny talks about this, is that she feels like she's unwelcome in the Republican Party, even though she's a conservative because she likes rap music and she won't abandon African American culture in where she lives. And so they're saying, don't tell me to be like you. Tell me why people like me would want to join your group.
And to me, that is one of the key differences when you look at the conservative movement versus the progressive movement right now. The progressive
yes.
movement is the collective.
Yes.
The conservative movement, it may be tribal. It may be a
yes.
loose confederation of individuals, but we're not the collective. We, you know, to me, conservatives are still the movement that understands that individuals are the of the utmost importance, right?
Right.
And
right.
that means that when you look around here, we shouldn't all be in agreement with one another on these on you know lockstep on every issue, even at a gathering of you know largely progressive or largely conservative people.
Well, that's what makes CPAC so great, is that there's so many areas that we're debating still.
Absolutely.
About what's conservative, what does it mean to be conservative,
and so you
what's
talk
the
about,
limits of that.
So you talk about Sonny Johnson,
yeah,
and we just interviewed earlier today, we're going to share this on next week's program, Phil Labonte, who is the lead singer of All That Remains.
I saw him come through here.
Right?
Yes, that's great.
And, you know, and he co-owns a gun store in New Hampshire, and, you know, he loves listening to talk radio. I'm sure he reads Hot Air all the time. He's kind of a political junkie, he said. That's his hobby when he's not, you know, creating music. I think he would probably say he's more of a libertarian, but he certainly felt at home here. So how is it that you can have people, you know, again, across this broad spectrum, who feel at home within a movement, or at least they feel comfortable saying I am a conservative,
right?
But they don't necessarily feel comfortable within the formal movement or within the party structure.
Well, I think it's because again, I think there's issues of purity, but when it comes to that exists even within CPAC, it's one of the reasons why we have such impassioned debate here, right? Is that, you know, we're, well, what's a conservative, you know? A conservative has to be this, 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 and this, and this, and all this done, you know, you have to check every single box. And you get some of that here, and some of that's just hashing things out among friends. And that's what's great about CPAC. But what I think people are afraid of when we talk about, well, we need to reach out to the African-American community, and we need to reach out to the Latino community, is that they think that that equates to pandering in some way. And because they have this idea that because the African-American community has been, at least for the last few decades, a monolithic Democratic voting bloc, that you have to offer Democratic policies to get them to vote for you. And that exact opposite is true.
Yeah.
What you need to do is you need to go ask them what their concerns are, and you need to show how the conservative agenda addresses those concerns. And that's what Going Red it is really about, is that don't be afraid to talk to people about what matters to you, but ask them first what matters to them.
Yep.
And then Sean Harrison in Florida, he represents a state district in the Tampa area, just north of Tampa, actually. It's called New Tampa. And he won his district in an off-year election. I think it was in 2010. He lost it in 2012 because Obama was able to turn out a lot of voters, and he lost it by, like, just 600 votes.
Oh, wow.
So the next time out, he says, I got to do what Obama did. I got to go talk to people, including people who aren't going to vote for me, to find out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So he went into these African-American precincts, predominantly African-American precincts around the University of South Florida, and he tells me, he says, I found out, first off, that I had no idea what their actual concerns were. I had a preconception of what it was. And so I was thinking, well, we need to come in here and talk about this. We need to tell them about this. And the fact is that Their set of concerns was different. And all they really wanted to do was be heard out on
that. I was going to say, that has to be one of the primary concerns, is you want my vote, but you're not willing to listen to me.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I think you're spot on with this, Ed. And I first noticed this phenomenon a few years ago. There was a town hall meeting in Chicago about the idea of what can we do about gun violence. And it was very audience-driven. It wasn't people, you know, at a podium saying, here's what we need to do. It was, okay, what do you think we need to do? What do you think about more gun control? And, you know, in Chicago, you had a lot of residents in pretty bad neighborhoods who said, no, we don't want more gun control. We want safer streets. We want you to take the criminals off the streets. We don't, you know, we've had all the gun control you guys have thought of, and it hasn't worked for decades.
Right.
But unless you're willing to listen, and that's the thing. In order to listen, you have to go into those communities, right? So
right.
You have to be willing to go in to Camden, New Jersey. I always use Camden as a reference because my wife spent 9 years there, and I don't think there was a Republican Party in Camden, New Jersey. There might be one for Camden County, but they weren't spending a whole lot of time in Camden City.
Right.
And you're right. It's not gonna immediately reverse decades of elections.
No.
That's not the point.
No, no.
That's not the point.
This is a long-term investment. But take a look at, take a look at what happened with Sean Harrison. Mm-hmm. He goes into these communities, and he talks to people. And, for instance, a big issue at that point in time was Stand Your Ground, because the Trayvon Martin shooting had just happened, within a few months of him going into these communities. And they did not like the Stand Your Ground law. Now, you and I know that Stand Your Ground wasn't really the issue in the Trayvon Martin shooting. It was really more of a straight-up self-defense question. And Stand Your Ground didn't really have anything to do with it. But they were exercised about the Stand Your Ground law. And Sean Harrison said, I understand your concerns, and I see how this is. I will tell you, you know, it applies this way. It doesn't apply this way. I still support the Stand Your Ground law, but I understand what your concerns are in this community about it, and we should work on ways to alleviate your concerns about this law. And, you know, they said that's all we really wanted to hear. We don't expect you to just change your mind because we're talking to you about mm-hmm. things, but come and tell us why you support this. Don't just tell us, oh, it's freedom, it's liberty. Tell us why you support it. Show us that you understand the ramifications of this law as we see it in our community. And so what he ended up telling was, look, I don't expect to get all of your vote. I don't expect to get half of your vote. I am telling you that if I can invest in this community and you can invest in me, I will owe you. If I win this election, I will owe you, and I will expect you to show up in my office and say, you need to deliver for us, and I will deliver for you. He says, now that we've talked to each other, we know each other a little bit, you should know that you can come into my office anytime and say, Sean, this is what we need, and I will see what I can do to deliver on it. And he ended up winning his next election by a very substantial margin. I think he won it by 7 points in a D+7 district.
Wow.
To give you an idea. And he had been defeated. He was no longer the incumbent at this point in time. And he did that because he was able, and I think he ended up getting something like around 20% of the vote out of these precincts that he'd been dealing with. And the Republican Party in Florida, or at least in the, I think it was the county Republican Party, was discouraging it, saying, don't waste your time. You're going to invest time in there. You're not going to get votes out of it. You should invest your resources elsewhere.
Mobilize your base, right?
Mobilize your base. And that's a recipe for a shrinking party. That is a recipe for a shrinking party. The only way you grow this party is to actually expand your territory and actually expand into communities that you've not already been in. And that's what Going Red is about. It's about reaching out to communities where we've been afraid to talk. We've been afraid to go. And there's no reason to be afraid. These people really want to have a conversation,
yep.
An honest conversation. They don't want to be lectured to.
Right.
They don't want to be told that they have to change in order for them to join conservatives. They want to know that they're valuable and that their insights are valuable and that they will add to the conservative movement by joining us and us respecting their contributions.
All right, we've got much more with Mr. Ed Morrissey from Hot Air and the new book, Going Red. There we go. But when we come back after a quick timeout, Andrew Marr and Chase Rowan going to be with us from the Warrior Angels Foundation. Stick around. We're just getting started here on this Friday edition of NRA News Cam and Company from CPAC 2016.
Speaking with Barry Woods with the National Wild Turkey Federation, welcome to NRA News. How are you, Barry?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. We love National Wild Turkey Federation. You guys are a great organization. But, Barry, for those who don't know, who are watching us, what is National Wild Turkey Federation? What do you guys do?
We are in the business right now of creating hunters. We just started a new initiative called Save the Habitat, Save the Hunt. And over the course of the next 10 years through our volunteer base, we're going to create 1.5 million new hunters.
That's awesome. Why did you guys feel it was necessary to do this?
Because unfortunately, hunter numbers are on a decline, and we recognize right away that if we're going to continue this heritage of the outdoors, that we're going to have to get kids off the couch, away from video games, and back into the outdoors. So, and we've also learned that several folks have gotten out of hunting for a number of different reasons: lack of access, lease prices, and things like that. So that's the other side of the initiative, is the habitat side, and we want to open access to 500,000 acres to help those people that we create to be hunters have a place to hunt.
That sounds great. So how are you going to go about doing this? You talked about opening access. What else is in the plan?
The other thing we're doing right now is what we're calling R3 is retention, recruitment, and reactivation. And we're also holding events across the country through our volunteer base where entire families can get involved in the shooting sports. We realized real quick that Pittman-Robertson Act and the way that it works in conservation is very important to the hunting heritage. And so we got to get these folks back engaged in the outdoors. So they can get to our website at nwtf.org.
Tell folks, why should they check out your website in this new initiative?
If you want to play a role in getting hunters and recruiting hunters and becoming a volunteer with the NWTF, it's going to take a workforce. It's going to take a lot of people coming on board and helping us achieve this mission. And so if you're interested in that, you need to get on our website.
Speaking with Greg Foster with Manta. Greg, welcome back to NRA News. What's new with Manta?
Well, Manta just continues to move forward in the heat mitigating material arena. We've got so much popularity around Class 3 firearms, the suppressor usage that's going nationwide, rail covers that go on the guns because they get hot, and that's where we stand out because the product is all a silicone polymer composite, all a proprietary mix, and yet it keeps the hand cool, keeps, if you're using a suppressor and they get pretty hot pretty fast, keeps you from burning yourself, somebody, something, just because of that property, that heat mitigation.
So this is an interesting display. You've got a lot of products on there. Give us a quick idea what they are.
And the key features are rail covers and the suppressor cover. That's basically the line. One of the key things that we do differently from anybody else is we actually have a wire management system built into the rail covers so that if you're using accessories that have wires, it allows you to run your wires in and out of the ports, down the canals, and then dump your micro pouch off into a specific switch area so that it locks it in place. Yet, if you want to take that off and move it someplace else, you're not taking off electric tape or zip ties or anything like that. You're just moving it.
So it gives you a really neat, functional sort of, not only an appearance, but just functionality to the firearm.
That's right. It dresses it up, keeps those wires out of the way, and yet still gives you all the properties of the heat mitigation so that as that rail gets hot, you don't even have to wear gloves. You've still got a good tactile rubber feel that really works great.
That's great. Greg Foster with Manta. How to get more information about the Manta products?
Just go to manta.us and go online, and we'll be happy to send catalogs. There's all kinds of YouTube videos on the product to see.
Greg, thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. We are coming to you today from CPAC 2016, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Our on-location sponsor, AdCore Defense. Still to come on the program this hour, Jesse Jane Duff from the London Center for Policy Research. And right now, I want to welcome here on set from the Warrior Angels Foundation, Andrew Mars with us, the CEO and founder of the foundation. Andrew, how are you, sir?
Cam, I'm fantastic. Thank you for letting us be on.
Oh, absolutely. And Chase Rowan is with us as well. Chase, thank you, sir, for coming on the program today.
Having a great time. Sorry.
Excellent. No, I understand. I appreciate it. And I'm glad to have you both here. So tell me, and we do, have, of course, have our friend Ed Morrissey from Hot Air, author of Going Red. I won't do the subtitle right now.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay. So, Andrew, what is the Warrior Angels Foundation all about? What do you guys do?
We were looking for an alternative means to psychotherapy and medication for treating traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress. Okay? That's how I was treated, and that's how hundreds of thousands of other people have been treated, and that has not improved anybody's quality of life. A matter of fact, it's only made matters worse. And so what we found is by addressing a certain type of hormones that are produced in the brain called neurosteroids, we can figure out what's deficient, what you're deficient in your neurosteroids, and we can bring that back up to your physiological levels, people get better. I was on 13 medications. I was an alcoholic. My wife was 9 months pregnant. Her only request of me is that I could not drink that for that day, because she was afraid she would have to drive herself to the hospital if she went into labor. You know, at that time I was like, that's it. I have got to find another means of what's going on. And that's when we started the road to finding the truth.
And so, you know, this is something obviously where we've got more veterans coming back home from Iraq and Afghanistan. We are learning more about PTSD. Some of us are learning, you know, about our friends and our family members who have PTSD, but we don't necessarily understand what causes that, right? And what the again, what the options are. So you feel like this is sort of, you know, when you go into the VA system or you go in and you talk to your doctor and you're diagnosed with PTSD, the automatic assumption is, well, let's medicate you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the protocol.
And Chase, I'm curious, your story as well. You're a former Army Ranger, right?
Yes, sir.
And thank you both, by the way, for your service and all that you've done. So tell me, how did you get involved with the Warrior Angels Foundation?
Well, Andrew and I have actually known each other for at least 15 years. We went to high school together, so we grew up together in a lot of ways. But I served in a 3rd Ranger Battalion in the Army, and after my deployment to Northern Iraq, came back, and during the training operation, I suffered a traumatic brain injury. My parachute didn't open fully. So therefore, I was then medically discharged from the Army, and shortly after being discharged, I was drugged up incredibly. And within about 18 months, my entire life just started to spiral downward.
I'd like to ask you guys, I mean, there's certainly been a lot of controversy over the Veterans Administration, the VA hospital system. I want to focus, though, really how that applies to this particular issue.
Right.
You know, the VA, for all of its other problems, generally is regarded pretty as a pretty high-quality provider for very specific battle type service-related injuries, service-related illnesses. Why do you think they haven't quite got a grasp on PTSD? Because this has been something that has obviously been an issue, really, going back to the Vietnam War, which is when we started really seeing a lot of these cases come back.
You have to really look at what is post-traumatic stress, and you have to look at traumatic brain injury. What we're now finding out is the majority of people are massively misdiagnosed with post-traumatic stress. By definition, post-traumatic stress is purely a behavioral and psychological issue. So if there is any physical trauma in that person's timeline, by definition, it can't be post-traumatic stress. So the first thing we need to look at is traumatic brain injury. And that's when we go and we say, okay, well, let's do an independent objective analysis of his blood to see where he's at. And we can then say, okay, this person is deficient in these very important neurosteroids that are responsible for making us who we are. Cognition, behavior, our physiology, our psychology, everything is wrapped up in it. And so if that is messed up and it's deficient and it's not working correctly, now we're going to have all these declines that we see in somebody's behavior. And it happens. It can happen slowly. It can happen during a day, a week, a month, a year after the injury. And so when that happens and a person starts having issues, they can't tie it to any one event. And they're going to the doctor and they're saying, I don't know what's happening, but I think I'm going crazy. And I don't have any reason to. And instead of doing their due diligence, the medical system, they say, okay, great, you're going on packet number A of drugs. And when that doesn't work, 3 months later, we'll up it and put you on packet B. So if you say you're depressed and you're put on antidepressants and you're still depressed, then that's probably not what's wrong.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's where we are in the system. So the good news is we weren't going to wait around for the government to solve it. My family didn't have the time. We have people in need. So we went out and found an alternative means, and we're disrupting the entire system.
That's great. I mean, is the VA listening now?
We've been in conversations with the highest echelons of the VA, and they're not going to have a choice. It's going to be one of two things. It's either going to go, they're going to have to accept it, or the current technology is going to advance so much that it'll democratize and dematerialize the current healthcare system. Where, right, you know, it's like, hey, do whatever you want. We can get this groundbreaking therapy, whether you want to pay for it or not.
Talking again with Andrew Marr, the CEO and founder of the Warrior Angels Foundation, and Chase Rowan as well with community relations for the foundation. So how do you folks raise funds, Andrew? What do you do to...
We're a 501c3, so we're a nonprofit organization. So, you know, we function off people's generosity. And the way I look at it is an investment. You're investing in somebody's life. We've now been able to treat over 100 veterans. Many were on a multitude of medications and had more than one attempt at suicide. And majority of our guys are completely off all medications and back and living life again.
Wow. That is amazing.
That's great. So we're just bringing the results and letting people understand what's out there and saying, hey, if this is a value to you, and it is to us, then this is a great way for you to be able to give back.
Well, listen, again, we cannot thank you enough for everything that you've done for this country, and thank you again for everything you
continue to do. It's on our website, Chase, www.waftbi.org. We have a plethora of information on there, put out a ton of stuff on brain health, all the social media. We're the cool kids with social media these days, so we're on all the hot links, and we're putting out, dropping knowledge bombs left and right.
Andrew, listen, thank you so much for coming by. It's a real pleasure.
Pleasure's ours.
Chase, thank you as well, sir.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for your service.
Andrew Marr, join us again with the Warrior Angels Foundation. Chase Rowan, join us as well here on NRA News, Cam and Company, as we come to you from CPAC 2016. We will be talking with Jesse Jane Duff, a veteran as well, with the London Center for Policy Research. Talking about more about the VA, Veterans Health Care. This is, you know, Ed, this is one of those stories. Every time you hear somebody within the administration say the Obama administration has been scandal-free.
Right.
Right. This is one of those that comes to mind where you think,
well, the VA, absolutely, yeah. This has been an ongoing scandal. And what's worse, the VA has been a mess for a very long time. And we've known it for a very long time. And we're still doing the same things that we were doing 20 years ago when we knew that the VA was a mess. I mean, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when the Vietnam veterans were returning and the VA system was completely out of control. People weren't getting addressed. People weren't getting help. And the problem with the VA system is that the VA system does some things tremendously well. They have expertise in, you know, again, service-related injuries, service-related wounds, service-related sicknesses, with apparently the exception of PTSD, but they do some things remarkably well. And the rest of it, they don't. And the rest of it, they shouldn't be doing. Routine care really should be something that we allow veterans to seek in any place, any place they need it, with the health insurance provided by the American taxpayers, because we owe these guys our liberties. And so we owe them a choice, and we're not giving them a choice. We're sticking them in a single-payer system that never reforms. And so, to some extent, the VA scandal has been around much longer than Barack Obama. Even before Barack Obama was running for Congress, we had a VA scandal. What the scandal was that we knew about it in 2008. It was actually, if people will recall, a pretty big election year talking point from Barack Obama and John McCain, who's still in the Senate. And it still was allowed to fester until we found out, and it was almost 2 years ago now, that they were defrauding veterans by mocking up wait lists and keeping them from seeing doctors in order to get bonus checks. I mean, I can't think of... This is basically blood money that these guys were arranging to pay themselves while veterans were dying waiting for care. It is despicable. And what's changed? We've known about it now for 2 years. How many people have been fired? They just reinstated two people that were fired over this.
We talked with the Daily Caller Foundation. Had a story last week about one of the administrators, the person who overran the VA system in St. Louis.
Yes.
Which had to be shut down on a couple of occasions because of patient health concerns, patient safety concerns. Ended up getting removed as the head of the VA system in St. Louis. Got transferred to the VA clinic in the Philippines, which is the only apparently foreign-run VA clinic that's there, and it's in the U.S. Embassy. It's very, very small.
Right.
Kept her $160,000 a year job, got her salary, was able to get a rent-free condo even in the Philippines there. So, you know, it's a lot cheaper to live in the Philippines than it is to live in St. Louis. Oh, by the way, her family was there in the Philippines.
Oh, what a shock.
So
I'm shocked.
Right.
Shocked.
I mean, right. So, again, you get dismissed because of the problems that developed under your watch, but you don't get fired.
No.
You get shuffled around.
You get shuffled around. And they had a scandal pop up, this I think about a month ago in Cincinnati, where whistleblowers finally raised the issue with local media that the the new management at the Cincinnati VA was cutting back on things like treating surgical instruments. What do you call it?
Sanitizer.
But yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Making sure that they were clean.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming to
sterilizing.
Sterilizing, thank you, for some reason. I'm a writer.
I understand.
I'm a writer. What was that word? Yeah, making them clean. Sterilizing surgical instruments. They were coming into the surgical room with pieces of tissue still on them because they never had been cleaned, and they would stop the surgery and say, go back and get these things cleaned or bring us fresh ones. And the administrator who was running this place said, you're not allowed to do that unless you personally call me and come down there. And if she was in a meeting, she wouldn't come out. So sometimes they had a patient on the table for as much as an hour waiting for her to come down and inspect the surgical instruments to see if they really needed to be sterilized.
Oh, my God!
I mean, this is insane. And the reason why they get away with it is because it's a single-payer system. Everybody's our veterans who can't, those veterans who can't get health insurance outside this system are locked into one provider system that has no accountability, where failure is not only an option, it's apparently a resume enhancer.
Right, exactly.
It's amazing. And they tried to blow the whistle on this, and the inspector general kind of buried it. So the Office of Special Counsel, which oversees the Inspector Generals, had to write up the Inspector General's office for not taking care of this situation. It's a scandal of immense proportions. And who are the victims? The men and women who keep us free.
Right.
The men and women who have sustained traumatic brain injuries on behalf of us in either here or abroad in supporting American military and foreign policy. They put themselves at risk for us. They come back here, and they're locked into a system that is absolutely, absolutely unaccountable. And in many instances, almost horrific.
Yeah. Talking again with Ed Morrissey. He's our guest co-host this hour as we broadcast from CPAC 2016. We are at National Harbor, Maryland, the Gaylord Convention Center. We are right smack dab in the middle of Radio Row. We really need to name these hallways, Ed. You know, like, I don't know what it would be, Elephant Way and...
Well, this is Smith and Wesson. And this is Ruger. We're right in the corner of Ruger and Wesson.
This is Maryland. I don't think I think you're not allowed to name streets after firearms in Maryland. I think the Firearm Safety Act banned that. When we come back after a quick timeout, Jesse Jane Duff is going to be with us. Walking our way right now from the London Center for Policy Research. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company right after this.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years. And then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So And it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and, you know, the little girl's got a wig on. She's been through hell. I can say hell, can I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago. 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years old. Or this is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it and it's like, so I have an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids,
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information, it is NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. A look, time-lapse, by the way. Nobody's moving that quickly at CPAC here on the hallway. Our on-location sponsor, Adcor Defense, coming up on the program next hour. We're going to say goodbye to Mr. Ed Morrissey, whose new book is called, Ed, there you go, Going Red.
Going Red. The 2 million voters who will elect the next president and how conservatives will win. Yes, I have to look at it to make sure.
It's okay. I had to do that with heavy lifting, too. Rick Unger from Steel and Unger is going to be with us next hour. Larry O'Connor from WMAL in Washington, D.C. And right now, I want to welcome to the program one of the two Jesse Duffs that appear regularly on this program. Jesse Jane Duff, a gunnery sergeant. Can we call you Gunny?
Oh, please do.
Yeah? Have you ever met Arlie Ermey, the other Gunny?
No, I have not.
Okay, I'm going to make that my mission this year.
That
would be awesome. To bring two Gunnies together.
That would be awesome. Although I think I look better in the dress and heels.
I think it's probably a fair assumption.
I don't even want to go there. No.
Yeah, that's...
it's a whole new military.
Yeah, it would be different.
A whole new military.
It is a whole new military. So, first of all, thoughts on CPAC this year?
You know, it's really hard to get in and out, which I think is going to be very frustrating for people. But it is an election year, and people have to be prepared to stand in line and go through the Secret Service. It's just the way it is. But actually, though, there's a lot of fabulous guests. I've seen some really significant people. So I like seeing all of the merging of ideas and thoughts, because we are a big party of ideas.
Absolutely. And, you know, we were just talking before the break about the VA scandal and scandals.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad that you're joining us on the program here because, you know, as Ed said, it's been 2 years now since the last scandal sort of erupted publicly.
The major one.
Right.
That got everybody's attention.
But has anything changed?
Okay, so, you know, I've been following this probably for over 4 years. And originally I was with Concerned Veterans for America, and we were big proponents of getting the VA overhauled. Okay, so over the period of time, we're trying to figure out why can't they fire these executives? Well, apparently they have this merit review board that after the VA even had recommended dismissal of various executives, it goes to this merit review board, and they're discarding all of this and basically saying, no, you got to reinstate their position. You either got to pay them back pay. And so now, God bless Secretary McDonald. I will say this for the first time. He's presented legislation in front of the Senate, he himself and the VA, to allow them to remove this process or to adjust this process, because what's happened is he's getting blatantly embarrassed. We had executives that were able to move to another location, get $400,000 in moving expenses. The VA inspected it, recommended removal, reduced them in position. This merit review board came back and said, oh, no. You got to pay them what they're worth in the position that they got. And it just was bad judgment. Bad judgment? $400,000? Now, Sharon Hillman, the queen who broke this all open, who basically up in Seattle, Washington, when she was up there, had ignored the veteran suicide rate. She was reporting lower numbers. And instead of removing her then, what do? They don't move them. They didn't move her out. They moved her up. She became the director of the VA in Phoenix, where all the secret waiting lists were happening, where people didn't realize they'd been waiting over a year to get treatment. 40 veterans died when they found out they weren't getting treatment. Well, guess what? All three charges, only one stuck because of this merit review board. Do you realize after they finally got her off the payroll, finally got her out of there, the only one she had to plead guilty to was accepting gifts from lobbyists? That's it. 40 veterans are dead. That got dismissed with the secret waiting list, all of this. And she won't even spend any time in prison. She's going to get about 5 weeks or 5 months of probation, something to that extent. I'm appalled. Appalled. Not held accountable on any level.
That's the problem with the single-payer system. Nobody's ever held accountable in a single-payer system.
And absolutely.
It's so frustrating. Cam and I were just venting over this. This is not a two-year-old problem. This is not a four-year-old problem. This is a decades-old problem. It was a campaign point in 2008. Both John McCain and Barack Obama were saying, oh, yeah, we need to reform the VA. John McCain's still in the Senate. Barack Obama is still president. Nothing has changed.
Yeah, and why is it they haven't repaired that merit review board before? Now, this is what I would say. I would caution everybody. This isn't just going on in the VA. This is going on everywhere. So what that tells you is that none of these executives throughout the SES system do get fired. So we're focusing on this VA, but it's going on in the Department of Energy. It's going on in education.
Well, I mean, actually, you know, the other day we were talking about the similarities between this, because we were discussing the former head of the VA system in St. Louis, who ended up being removed. The facility had to be shut down on two separate occasions, I guess, for patient well-being concerns, possibly exposed 5,000 VA patients to HIV. She asked for a transfer to the Philippines. That's where her family lives. So she got to go. Now she's overseeing the VA clinic in the U.S. Embassy in the Philippines, still making $160,000 a year.
Unreal.
As a government-paid condo.
Unreal.
Right? But you go back and you look at, like, Operation Fast and Furious.
Yeah.
Who got fired with Operation Fast and Furious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody. U.S. attorney in Phoenix was allowed to resign, had a going-away party, got praised by... They give him a cake. You know, I mean, like, that's what happens when you screw up. You get a cake.
Well, there was an executive, Jack Hetrick. He was the VA's highest-ranking VA official in Ohio, and they investigated him for neglect and mismanagement. And, in fact, it was so clear that Undersecretary Sloan had said, we're going after you. You know, he did. He submitted his retirement papers, retired, and the VA says they have to pay him his benefits and everything because they've been earned. So now what? What are you going to do? Are you going to bring criminal charges? Because what good is that? Because obviously the Merit Review Board is going to turn around and flip it and say, no. I am appalled that this has gone on, but I am pleased to hear that the VA secretary is now introducing legislation that will make it easier for him. But how come nobody's figured this out up to now?
Right.
How come?
Yeah, and how come this isn't, how come this isn't a priority? How come we're hearing about Marco Rubio's boots and, you know, the silly stories of the day? This is what drives me crazy.
Yeah, the election's getting to
that,
be really
But not
a
even
joke.
Just the election.
Yeah. Or
you
the
know?
Campaigning.
I mean, like, whatever it is, it can be the Oscars, right? There's always going to be a distraction. to keep us from talking about these serious problems and these serious flaws. Absolutely. We're talking about, our veterans. As you said, these are the men and women who sacrifice for us, who put their lives on the for us, their families sacrifice for us. The one thing that I think, you know, again, this isn't a socialistic program, but the one thing that Americans, I think, are pleased and proud to do is to support our veterans, to make sure that they are not forgotten, that they are not left behind, and for God's sake, that they're not dying waiting to see a doctor because, you know, somebody doesn't want to fix the real problem, just wants to paper over the differences so that they keep getting their government
bonuses. They keep getting their bonuses, exactly.
But what I would also caution, everybody says support the veterans. What's happened also is the VA takes advantage of that, and they've gotten an increase in their budget every year for probably the last 6 years.
Yes.
And they're finally starting to put the brakes on, allowing more money, because this isn't a money problem, people. This is a management and executive problem. You have, the VA has the second largest budget next to DOD. That's how enormous and how bloated they are. They have, 300,000 employees, largest bureaucracy.
Yeah.
So when you start talking about money, that doesn't solve all problems, and it doesn't mean you're anti-vet because you say, hold on, show me what you're going to do with that money. And why is it the VA Accountability Act that passed, that made them allow veterans choice? Many of these veterans are going off the reservation, going and getting care from private care providers. The VA is not even paying the bills on time, and it's getting on their credit reports.
Yeah, this was something, and I want to just emphasize what Jesse says here, because when this scandal broke, Democrats initially came out and said, well, it's because Republicans wouldn't fund the VA properly.
It's always
So I went back and I checked this, And I did this whole spreadsheet of the actual expenditures for the Veterans Administration over a period of 14 years. From 2001, you know, from the 9/11 period, where we started going into two different wars and obviously had a much greater need for VA care for these soldiers, sailors, airmen. And no department had its budget increased more on a percentage basis than the Department of Veterans, or the Veterans Administration.
They're never denied.
Never denied. It was something like 79%. Take it back. It was more than 79%.
It's about 80 or 90%.
And the only department that had more, had increased more on a dollar basis, was the Department of Homeland Security, because it went from nearly nothing because it didn't really exist.
Right.
And so they were the only ones that increased more on a dollar basis over that same period of time. And that was under both Republican and Democratic administrations. A constant increase of money for the Veterans Administration, and that money is not buying one single bit of accountability. And I'd argue it's actually undermining accountability.
I think that you're right. I mean, look, first of all, this is money that is allocated to the Department of Veterans Administration, not allocated to veterans, veteran
to
care.
Veterans Affairs.
Right. So, look at Washington, D.C.'s per pupil expenditure in the public schools.
Right.
Right. It is one of the most spendy programs in the country.
Yes.
Well over $20,000 a year per student. Look at the results, right? I mean, like, we know this. We know that it's not simply a matter of throwing money at the problem and fixing it. There actually has to be a willingness to acknowledge the problem, and then there needs to be that commitment to fix the problem. And a lot of times, again, as you say, it's not a funding issue.
No.
It's an accountability issue.
And they resist allowing veterans to have veterans choice, where they can go out, because what happens is, and this is my theory and I believe it to be true, if you lose your source of revenue and outsource it, that means you can't request more money.
Right.
So they are making it so difficult for many of these veterans to get outside medical care with the bureaucracy, the paperwork, you know, going through this whole entire process. Why would that be? Because if you can actually get some competition, it might shut some of your operation down.
Right.
You know, and that's the reality of it. So it's a very, very grave situation. And it's only going to get worse till it gets better. I think that if the Phoenix scandal didn't square things away, what else is it going to take? Because Phoenix was not the only place. The IG report came out that they reviewed all of these facilities. They saw that wait lists were pretty much systemic, and the senior executives were teaching people how to do it. Because what happens is, to get a bonus, you have to show you're giving these people care within 45 days or 30 days of the appointment. That was the policy of the VA. So they hide it. So somebody's waiting 120 days. They're just adjusting the numbers. And many of the whistleblowers were reporting it. Many of them have received reprisal. So this is something that, to get a bonus, you have to prove that you kept a wait list under 30 days. Why not look at the results and survey the veterans in that facility and see if they're getting their care on time before you get a bonus?
Absolutely, right?
Exactly.
Jesse, listen, I cannot thank you enough. Clearly, this is a subject that you are incredibly, not just passionate about, but engaged in. And if folks, I mean, you're writing about this, you're talking about this, what is the best way for folks to keep up with you and what you are doing?
Well, to keep up with me, you've got to run fast. You know, that's probably the you know, I'm always
well, I'm
on
out.
The go. So, okay. Easiest way is probably through Twitter because I'm pretty prolific on Twitter, at Jessie, J-E-S-S-I-E, Jane, J-A-N-E, Duff, D-U-F-F. People confuse me often with Jessie Duff, so I'm sending her direct messages all the time. I think this is for you. I've been congratulated for many award-winning shots, which I find to be quite honorable. But there's nobody better I could be also have share a name with. I also want to say one thing about women in combat, fighting in combat. Many people don't realize the combat exclusion has been lifted. The military is now actively going out to recruit women to put them in the infantry. And this is happening now. They're going to probably start in June. And I want to warn people, women are 5 times the cost of men to recruit because of the amount of rate of attrition we have. We fall out, and 2 times the rate of disability and injury, and that's not even in the infantry. Nobody's talking about it. It got lifted by the Pentagon. Congress did nothing. So we're going to watch our tax dollars go in for something that's not even going to make us more lethal. And all evidence determines that it doesn't make us even maintain our combat readiness. So when your daughter joins the military, folks, she could get reassigned to the infantry.
Jessie Jane Duff, Gunnery Sergeant, U.S. Marine Corps retired, now with the London Center for Policy Research. Thank you, as always. And you're always welcome back anytime.
Oh, I'll be showing up then.
All right, there you go. Hour two, Mr. Ed Morrissey, thank you, sir, for joining
us.
We'll let you go when we come back. David Webb, host of the David Webb Show, going to join us. Stick around. There's more NRA News Cameron coming from CPAC 2016 coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Vicki Callmaker. Vicki, you do so much. Women's Shooting Academy, 1 Million United, Safety Academy. Where do you want to start? Should we start with Women's Shooting Academy?
Absolutely. Let's start with Shooting Academy.
All right. Welcome to NRA News. What's it all about?
The Women's Shooting Academy really came to be, I thought I was just going to teach one class, right? I thought I was just going to teach women how to shoot a gun. And over the last 7 or 8 years, it's just really evolved into something that I could have never imagined. And I've trained thousands of women. And I'm just all about the art of self-preservation.
What is that? Tell me what you mean when you say the art of self-preservation.
You know, I want women to realize that they're worth protecting, their family is worth protecting, and obviously, you know, if we're going to go gun, that is the equalizer. I'd like to see every woman carrying a gun. But at the same time, I realize that a gun is not for every woman. And so it's really taking her on a journey, a personal journey, about her personal safety and getting her to realize that she can own it, she can embrace it, she can fight for it, and she can lose it.
Wow. So how do you do that at Women's Shooting Academy?
Well, our most popular class is called Introduction to Handguns. And what I do with the students is they show up, they spend about 5 or 6 hours with me in the classroom. They learn how to load and unload. They learn everything there is to know about a firearm. And part of that is teaching them the lingo so that when they end up at the gun counter, they don't sound like an idiot. And teaching them the proper way to stand, to hold the gun, really focusing on the fundamentals. Then I take them to the range, and I provide the guns, the targets, the ammunition, and they shoot 5 calibers. They shoot both revolvers and semi-automatics. And after an 8-hour day, they're ready to go to the gun counter, and they can do that alone. They can buy their first handgun by themselves. And then, you know, if they want to come back and take some additional training, absolutely. If they want to get their concealed carry permit, we can do that. They want to learn about shotguns for home defense, we can do that. I'm really excited because I'm starting to see that women want to shoot the big guns. They want to shoot the ARs. They want to shoot this fun stuff. And when they realize it's not as complicated as they thought,
right,
they're in.
There you go. Speaking with Vicki Callmaker, so let's talk about 1 Million United. What is that?
So 1 Million United actually started out to be very political. And it was my answer back to Mr. Bloomberg several years ago. Don't tell us we cannot unite. So hence 1 Million United.
Right.
But over the last year and a half, it's evolved. And what I decided to do with 1 Million United was to turn it into a 501c3 nonprofit. Because I believe that there's women across this entire country who need to hear what I have to say. And I want to offer that to them 100% no charge. I see myself on a large platform teaching safety seminars and really uniting women. And so One Million United will be 100% donor funded. And, you know, I got to learn how to raise money. I don't know how to raise money, but I need to raise money. And so that will allow me to just broaden my services. You know, I've got my for-profit companies. Let's do something that will benefit every woman across the country.
All right, almost out of time. How can we get more information about everything you're up to?
Go to VickiCallmaker.com, and from there you can find One Million United, the Women's Shooting Academy, and everything else I do.
Vicki Callmaker, thanks for what you're doing. You're doing so much, and thanks for being here on NRA News. Stay in touch with us. How about
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Hour 2 of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Looking live at the ballroom at the Conservative Political Action Conference in National Harbor. Gaylord Convention Center. We are very pleased to have with us on the program right now, all hour long, Mr. David Webb. How are you, David? And oh, my goodness gracious, what is this?
What is this? Are we getting...
Hello, Cupcake.
Oh.
Policy in America.
I love
besides
any.
Myself, by the way.
I love besides anything myself. That starts with
so
dessert.
Each right. of you can have one of these. They are Irish Car Bomb cupcakes.
Oh, my.
Oh.
I know. Yeah, they are delicious. Made
I can
by
smell
our good
them,
friend
actually,
Jenny Kruda and the Kruda Bakery. Third generation family-owned bakery coming from the great state of Illinois. And they are some of the few conservative, gun-owning, gun-loving, Second Amendment-supporting people in Illinois. So... You
wow.
should, every bite is America, even though it's called an Irish car bomb.
Well, it's part of the fabric of America. We're close to St. Patrick's
there
Day.
You go.
Right. We're within a couple of weeks.
Take one. Here, I'll make it easy.
One?
It's good. It, yeah. Get, oh, get a cupcake out. Get
you
a cupcake
do know
out.
The difference between an Irish wedding out. And an Irish funeral, right?
Cam, it's no good if you don't get it all over
right.
your beard.
I was going to say, there's
get
no,
it all over.
I
get
don't normally
over.
Do this on camera.
Yes, you
but,
do. You do.
Somewhere
you
out
do.
There, there's a website where you charge like $3 a minute to watch a bearded guy eat a cupcake. You know that?
Don't give him ideas. Maybe that'll, I'll put that up on dataradio.com
later. That's all about
Thank
here.
You, guys.
Mm. Oh, yeah, that's good.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. You know, they said you're not supposed to eat on camera,
thank
but
you,
I'm against
Dana.
That rule.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for the napkins as well. Wow. See, this is, you know, the type of stuff that you really only see at CPAC.
Mm-hmm.
Not bearded guys eating cupcakes, but yeah. Dana Lash delivering cupcakes.
Cupcake
on the
cupcake,
air.
From
right?
a cupcake.
Oh, goodness gracious. That is oh, God, good. I'm going to have to put this
good.
Down here for a second.
Yeah, hang on.
So
I'm taking one more bite.
Now I've got all of my fingers here. Coming up on the program this hour, David's going to be sitting in with us all hour long. It is a pleasure, as always, to get a chance to spend some time with you.
Is that why I only
you.
Get one cupcake? Because if I eat a couple of these, I may not make
That's
it
right.
through
all
the
of a sudden,
hour.
You, know, you get the sugar rush, then you get the sugar crash, and then you're falling asleep on Rick Unger and... That's not good. Rick Unger from Unger.
Just the thought of that sounds
Steel and Unger.
Just the thought of that sounds
wrong. Rick, let me just put my head on your shoulder. Larry O'Connor from WMAL in Washington, D.C. is going to join us. We've got the Radio Power Hour here on NRA News Cam and Company. And, David, you've been part of the huge, serious lineup that's over there. I mean, what, four channels here on Radio
Row. We have
Row.
Taken over. I mean, remember a few years ago when... They said, let's go to CPAC, and Dave Gorab and I had a talk, and I said, I've got an idea. And I think Dave's starting to get the point that when I say I've got an idea, they ought to consider it. New Hampshire, I've got an idea. Let's create a room. Now we take over the Red Arrow Diner.
Mm-hmm.
But this is how we do it. I mean, this is about presenting the platform. We broadcast to the left, to the right, to the middle, and we want to give America the voices. We want to let them hear all the perspectives.
Absolutely. And so you've got SiriusXM Patriot.
Right.
You've got SiriusXM Progress. You've got POTUS.
POTUS, the POTUS channel is there.
And you've got Insight. Yeah. All broadcasting live.
All broadcasting live, recording, doing interviews. I'm doing a mixture of live and pre-recorded, but I'm also recording for next week. And one of the things that I've focused on, so we brought a diversity of broadcast platforms and political points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And my interviews throughout all of this have been about the diversity in the Republican Party and the conservative movement and the unity that's needed. So I've interviewed the atheists, I've interviewed the log cabins. I've interviewed the, everything. You name it, libertarian, the millennials. The whole idea is to show the nation outside of the echo chamber in here that there really are a wide number of people welcome here.
Absolutely. I mean, look, and that's not a bug. That's a feature of conservatism, right? Because when your bedrock principles involve the dignity of the individual and the rights of the individual, well, that means that we're all different because we're all individuals,
right? How boring would it be if we were all alike?
Exactly. And so, you know, we were talking about this a little bit last hour on the program with Ed Morrissey. You know, I think a very simple way of describing politics these days is on the left, you have the collective.
Right.
Right. You've got the people who are largely in lockstep and in agreement with one another's philosophy. On the right, you have sort of the tribes. You've got different groups of people, and again, you know, the individual, I think, is paramount, but you've got economic conservatives. You've got the three legs of the stool, right? The economic conservatives, the social conservatives. You've got the libertarians you can throw in there as well,
right.
The conservatarians. None of us agree 100%, except that if we agree that we've got each other's back and that you've got the right to live your life
as you
see fit, right, that's our common ground.
Well, it goes fundamentally to who we are. It should be is individual liberties protected in our Constitution. Your right, you know, and like you, I'm that constructionist. This thing, this document is not this bendable, adjustable document that the left has. It's a document of common sense. It's a document that's meant to be amended, but very difficult to do that because that's how it should be. And in it, individual rights, individual liberties to go along with the promise in the Declaration of Independence. So we have a cultural DNA, we have a legal DNA, and frankly, the conservative movement has held true to that. And we've had our problems, we've had our failures. You've heard me criticize the Republicans, the establishment, so to speak. I don't want to tear it down. I want to rebuild a working establishment so where we're unified on issues, where we stand on the Second Amendment, where we stand on the First Amendment, where we stand on the Tenth Amendment, another area that's been assailed, or the Fourth, our right, you know, all our freedoms, where all those things intersect. Let's unite behind that. And like any family where we don't agree with each other, tell me one family that agrees with each other 100% on any issue. There isn't one.
Right.
And we are a family of conservative-minded people, and we're going to have our debates, and we should. And we're going to intellectualize, not emotionalize, like on the left with their collectivist approach to doing things. So let's have that debate, have it honestly, and at the end look at each other and go, you know what, we agree on 60%, 62%, 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10. Anybody who agrees with me 100% is screwed. and then we move forward. And that's how America works best.
So what's the block, David, in your opinion? Like, why have we forgotten this? What's standing in the way of us doing this? Why is it easy for us to remember that this is how it's supposed to be and so hard for us to put this in practice?
I have a couple of words I ascribe to that, or I apply to that. Power and hubris. What has happened is the Republican Party establishment, and by that I don't just mean the elected officials, the RNC, the funders, the donor class, the consultants, but the entire structure has become more about maintaining the structure in too many ways rather than how the party was initially founded. We've lost that, and that's what happens just like big government. When you become so big, you actually first are focused, or too often are focused, on maintaining your structure. You've lost the ability to be adept, to adapt, to be swift, to work honestly and have those debates about solutions and then enact them. And that's what's happened with the establishment and the Republican Party. I don't want to tear it down. I want to tear out the bad parts and put it back into there. And it's not about what I believe in or what I agree with. It's the foundation. You look at the 10 basic principles of who we are and what we believe in. Fiscal conservatism, the rights of the individual, all the things that go along with our Constitution, and also supporting the culture and American exceptionalism. All those things need to be put back into proper perspective. And then we, on the outside, we have to do something very important that we fail to do as a voting populace. When they don't do the job, vote them the hell out of office. It's that simple. we've forgotten that we actually are in charge of the party.
Absolutely. And that we're in charge of the country, I think, in many ways.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
citizen government means something. We the people mean something. We've forgotten the responsibility that comes with that.
And not only have some of us forgotten this, I think the scary thing is that we've got Americans who are growing up never learning this. They never have the opportunity to forget because they don't know it in the first place.
That is a huge problem. I think back to high school. I think back to civics. People assail the idea of saying the Pledge of Allegiance. They forget that it was more than the words and more than what it meant. It was a moment when you kind of had that ingrained in you that it matters to be who we are as a country. And civics has been ripped out of the schools. Mm-hmm. Critical thinking has been ripped out. The pollution by the ultra-progressive liberal left in education. You know, how many times have I done stories and exposés over the years on books that are written with not incorrect, but outright lies? And you look at the publishing industry and the game that's played, that's at the expense of our country. How many times have you had people call up and they don't understand how the republic works or what a republic is?
Right.
We have a democratic system. We're not pure democracy, which is mob rule. But there are people who don't understand that.
Oh, just engage with a Bernie Sanders supporter online and ask them to explain democratic socialism. And you'll get an object lesson of what's not being taught in schools because, you know, there's this meme, I think, that the Sanders campaign put out that says democratic by the people, socialism for the people. So therefore, democratic socialism, David, is just by the people, for the people. That's all that it means. What does that even mean?
I mean, I don't know. Again, Debbie Wasserman Schultz doesn't even know what it means.
That's a word salad, right? I mean, it means absolutely nothing. And we are, as you say, we are forgetting and failing to teach the next generation some really basic building blocks of civic responsibility. I remember a couple of years ago, I think it was the last year that CPAC was over in D.C. before it had moved over
the
here.
Over the old ward, Mark, yeah.
Richard Dreyfuss showed up. Now, Richard Dreyfuss is not a conservative guy, although I think he might have been spotted at a Ted Cruz rally earlier this year.
Well, he was. He and his son went to the rally so they could explore the system. And, you know,
But he was here or there at CPAC talking about the need for civics education. And, like, that was it. You know, and he wanted to get folks on the left, the right, the middle, anywhere. This is something we should all be able to agree on, right? If we live in a nation where we have a written constitution, it's probably a good idea if we know what that says. And it's probably a good idea if we know why it says what it says.
Absolutely. And you just hit on, you know, when you take what you just said and you go back to what you said about collectivism, if you remove civics, if you remove critical thinking, you are able to form people into collectives. You're able to prey on their fears. You sell envy. And this is what's happened on the progressive movement in this country. Think about how easy it is if somebody has a lack of understanding to say, let me tell you what it means. Democracy for the people. Was it for the people or by the people?
By the people.
And socialism for the people. They've just twisted something that anybody with good civics education could say, bullshite. That's my toast to the Irish car bomb.
I think David's feeling the effects of that as well here.
It's really scary. If I don't need that to do this or coffee, and I've had no coffee today, you're in real trouble. But it's by the way, cool to be here, man.
It is great having you on the program. I mean, listen, we get along so well. I wish we had the opportunity to actually hang out more often.
Yeah, our schedules are just so divergent, and we're always running. But
I know, but I love the fact you're able to sit with us for an hour. We've got Rick Unger, who we've started having on the program thanks to you, by the way.
Yeah,
we
Rick's a good guy.
And,
you know, he's
absolutely.
Republican with his money, Democrat with ours.
But, you know, one of the things that we're getting ready to talk with Rick in just a couple of minutes here. And one of the things I like about this is that, you know, getting a chance to have Rick on the show, I don't have a problem with talking with people who I disagree with.
Actually, that's more fun.
It is.
It's more engaging, but it's also more fun.
What I have no interest in is getting somebody on who I disagree with, and then it devolves into a screaming match, and it's, you know, you suck, and you're awful. You want to see, you know.
You mean like the debates?
Yeah, exactly. Or frankly, you know, too much, I think, of cable television news.
Mm-hmm.
If I have somebody on that I disagree with, I want to explore why they believe the way they believe. And I think part of the problem that we have here in our political system right now is we are, you should never be unafraid to take somebody at face value.
Right.
It doesn't mean that you have to agree with them, but you should never be afraid to take someone's position and say, okay, I think that they probably believe that they have a legitimate reason to feel this way. Let me explore this.
Right.
Instead of immediately thinking, oh, you believe this way? Well, I'm going to shut down.
Well, it comes down to the fundamental problem, which is we're arguing, or some are arguing or prefer to argue over what's right and what's wrong, or rather who's right and who's wrong, when you should be talking about what's wrong and how you address the issue. And that's what we're seeing going on in our political discourse right now. I'm right, you're wrong. I'm right, you're wrong. You're right, I'm wrong. Whatever this, nobody's talking about, hey, guys, here are some fundamental issues. How would you approach fixing this problem?
Right.
How would you approach fixing this problem?
Absolutely. You know, so when it comes to, we talk about, you know, violent crime or gun violence, you know, I'm not going to insult somebody's character or intelligence if they support gun control laws, but I think that those are ineffective solutions for making a society safer. You know, let's talk about what works. Let's talk about going after the people who are actually committing violent crimes. Let's talk about things that can be done. Again, the policies, the programs. I think
right.
we're all in agreement that we want to see violent crime go down. Right? I mean, I think that's
a
fairly...
That's like saying we want to breathe air. Of course, we want a safer, sound society with violent crime
right.
as much
so,
out of the picture.
But so that's not the argument, except when you listen to a lot of the anti-gun activists, they want to say that's where the argument is. David,
no.
You don't care. You don't care about those those poor victims of crime. You don't care about people who are going to get hurt. You know, you just care about your rights. You don't care about the people. And so immediately it's an attack on you as opposed to...
Attacking the issue.
Right.
It comes down to the when did you stop beating your wife culture argument. That's really what it is. The premise in the question that you beat your wife. When did you stop? That's what I call it. Because that's it. Ad hominem. You don't care. How did you determine I don't care unless I tell you I don't care? Just believe me. You've known me a long time. I'll tell somebody when I don't give a crap. But, you know, one of the things and what I like about what you do, Cam, is, and not just on the Second Amendment, but you talk about culture, you attack all different issues within society, is we're similar in that you're asking people to present their case and make their argument. You bring the debate on. You say, okay, let's address the issue. And you don't simplify it. Often these things are not black and white. Mm-hmm. Some things are. Shades of gray. And you need to work your way through that. And that's frankly why I love doing what we do. Talk radio, in your case, big TV star, you know.
Well, you know, you're right, though. I mean, in talk radio, you are able to get that. You're able to have the time to explore these things, you know, on a three-hour program, even if you want to spend an hour on a topic.
Right.
It gives you time to delve in. You're not, in fact, an 8-second, 10-second soundbite doesn't work real well as the basis for an hour-long discussion on something, right? You have to be able to delve into the issues. I think you do a fantastic job with that on the David Webb Show. I'll tell you what, why don't we take a timeout?
Yeah.
And when we come back, Rick Unger.
He doesn't get an Irish car bomb.
No, I don't think so. Rick's going to be with us. We love Rick, but he doesn't get cupcakes. Anyway, when we come back, Rick's going to join us from Steel and Unger on Sirius XM POTUS. We've got more with our friend David Webb. So stick around. There is more coverage of CPAC 2016. Again, our on-location sponsor, Adcore Defense. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Jim Sapieca, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, in this installment, we want to talk about the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum. Tell us what it's all about.
Well, that is the newest of our three museums. We have the NRA National Firearms Museum here at NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. The NRA National Sporting Arms Museum was opened 2 years ago at the Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri, and it is a spectacular museum. There are about 1,000 historic arms there, and of course, as you'd guess, there's an emphasis on sporting arms, the arms of hunting, of sport shooting, but it goes far, far beyond that. We have exhibits that include guns of the Old West. We've got some great new guns that are just coming in and will be on display soon, Bat Masterson. Bass Reeves, who is a very iconic Old West figure, the first African-American U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi, and one of the most prolific lawmen of the Old West in terms of number of arrests, number of gunfights, a remarkable Old West figure that has been mostly overlooked until just the past few years. That museum, the really gratifying thing about that museum is the attendance. We just hit a milestone, opened 2 years and 2 months, and we have had 700,000 people through that museum. And so it's almost 1,000 a day. Yeah. And the demographics there, we get a lot of families, a lot of, mom, dad, and the kids coming through. Right. And it's just great. And you see the parents pointing out the different things to the kids, and then the kids taking them by the hand and saying, come over here and see this.
How do we get more info about that museum?
That museum, all the NRA museums are at the website, nramuseums.com, or you can go visit the museum in Springfield, Missouri at the Bass Pro headquarters shop there. It's open every day of the year except Christmas, and admission is always free at all three of the NRA museums.
I'm a mom, and just like millions of other women, that's why I own guns. We're responsible, we're law-abiding, and we're everything that makes America strong. Every day we're willing to use a firearm to defend our families. But the media will never tell those stories. If a mom puts a gun to the face of a home-invading thug and makes him run for his life, the story gets buried. But if she's unarmed and murdered, the cameras will be at the scene before the police. It's time for moms like me to speak out. We are the majority. We demand the freedom to defend our families. And we challenge the media to tell the truth about our rights. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
You critics don't define our honor. You try to shame us for doing our job. You teach children to fear us, crowds to attack us, and good people to doubt us. But we will never back down from our sworn duty to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. We wake up every day, put on our badge, strap a gun to our hips, kiss our families goodbye, and put our lives between the law-abiding and any criminal who threatens their rights. We serve people of every color and creed, men, women, and children in violent, dangerous neighborhoods, because they have the same right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as CEOs, movie stars, and the political elite. We are Americans. And we are the American police officer. We stand with the National Rifle Association of America, and the NRA stands with us. Together, we're freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. We are coming to you from CPAC 2016 at the Gaylord Convention Center, just downstream from Washington, D.C., on set with us all hour, almost said in studio, on set, all hour, our guest co-host David Webb from the David Webb Show on Sirius XM Patriot 125, and also very pleased to actually meet in person for the very first time.
Did you say NRA?
NRA.
I thought this was the NEA, the National. I'm not supposed to be here.
You've been so confused this entire time. Oh, Rick.
It's okay. You're a liberal. You're typically confused.
It's you guys.
And often wrong, as usual.
I am so sorry if we've gotten you in trouble with the collective, Rick.
It's okay. I won't be able to go to the meeting this month. But
it's okay. You just have to agree to whatever they came up with.
Well, I thought you were giving out free guns. That was the only reason I came.
This is Maryland, buddy. Yeah. We can't do that.
Dude, you hid them when the liberal came.
Just for you?
This is not equal protection under the law.
I'll tell you what, I'll give you the bullet.
Thanks. And I know where you're going to give it to me.
Rick Unger is the co-host of Steel and Unger. You can now hear it weeknights on Sirius XM POTUS. Rick, thank you so much again for coming
Always
on the program.
Always a pleasure.
Today.
Great to see you.
It is great to see you, too. And so, obviously, you two have a very good relationship, very close relationship,
David.
Right?
Yeah, I never
David
liked
Webb?
Him much.
Yeah. Never liked him. Yeah. I like his mom.
My mom doesn't like
his
him.
His mom's cool.
Yeah, he might like her, but she doesn't
like
him.
I like her. No, she does. She does.
I like his wife better.
He does. He definitely
his
likes wife my
wife likes
better.
Me better. She's married
no
to him, but she likes
it.
Me better.
No question about it. I admit this.
This is so unique. Like, if you watch cable television, this isn't supposed to happen. You're not supposed to have two people who disagree with each other politically able to get along.
How dumb is that?
Right?
Yeah. I just don't get that. I don't understand why people would pick their friends based on their politics. That's absurd.
It was always absurd to me. Goodness, when I met my wife, she was a Utah conservative. Obviously, I didn't mind. I married her, and that was 30 years ago. She's not quite as conservative as she used to be. I've rubbed off on her a bit.
Are you as liberal as
they do have a good work? They do have a good working plan. She's never home.
Great question. Did you hear what he said?
What?
He asked if I was as liberal as I used to be, and I said no.
No, he's not. That's a great question. Let's get it out in the open. Rick's a Republican with his money and a Democrat with ours.
That's right.
So how is the move to weeknights going for you over on POTUS? You guys having a lot of fun? I mean, certainly there's no shortage of things to talk about.
I love it. It's kind of messed with the dinner schedule, you know. Yeah. But then I'm 65, so we eat at 3:30 usually. Anyhow, so it's not that big of a problem.
Is there a Denny's near the studio?
I wouldn't know.
Okay.
Like I said, I'm a Republican with my money. I love the time period. I really do. And I love doing five nights a week. I really, really, really do.
What is it like working goal. With Michael Steele?
Michael and I have a great time together.
Well, he's already used to working with a black guy.
That's true. That's true. Not that pleasant working with this black guy, but, you know, you do what you have to get ahead. You know how it is, right?
In other words, you used me to get to Michael.
Yeah, that's not. Actually, I used Lanny Davis to get to Michael. Now, we have a lot of fun. We get along very well. But, you know, I'll tell you what, when you do a show with a partner, it is like being married. It really and truly is.
Yeah.
So, you know, things will come up, and my first thought is, all right, if this was Kathy, how would I handle this? And he does the same. I know he does. And it helps to approach it that way. But we, you know, for some reason, our chemistry was good from the first minute we were on together. He actually, when I would guest host, and Lanny Davis is an old friend of mine, so they were partners at the time, and I would have Lanny and Michael on together. And it was always a great segment, but I noticed, for some reason, Steele and I clicked. And that was really what set the whole thing up.
Again, I think he always had a thing for black guys.
Yeah, you know, I'm a suburban white guy.
I mean, what happened to poor Lanny? You just threw poor Lanny out in the cold. You know, these liberals are vicious, man. When they want something, they'll stop at nothing till they get it.
I'm a suburban white kid, man. We grew up wanting to be black. It's just that simple, you know.
We are talking with Rick Hunger from Steele and Hunger on the POTUS channel. Man, you are throwing me for some loops here, Rick. I got to tell you.
This little, we got to take this show on the road.
We have done it before.
But here's what I love is that, like, if this were taking place on a college campus right now, you would just have half the audience cringing. You'd have half the audience on their feet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then you'd have the other half, microaggressions. You're not. Quit it. Stop it. You're hurting my feelings.
This is the problem. And I got to tell you something. You know, here we are at CPAC. I get treated incredibly well at CPAC. I can't walk 3 feet without somebody coming up, sticking their finger in my face, going, I hate everything you say. But, you know, you seem like a really nice guy. Yeah. Can we get our picture taken together?
We do pity the less fortunate among us and the less equipped to handle things.
I'm leaving now. I've had enough of it.
Look, I'm just trying to see if I can insult them off the stage.
Insult me off the stage. But I have to tell you this. Netroots Nation, which is kind of the liberal version of CPAC.
Yeah.
David would not be treated as well there as I'm treated here. And I think that's not okay. And I have a problem. And I don't go to Netroots Nation for that reason. I don't need to hang around. The people here, we disagree on pretty much what time it is. Mm-hmm. But they're nice people. Those are two very different things. Political disagreement is political disagreement. So what? You know what you're talking about? You're going to be right as often as I'm right.
And by the way, you know? This is one of the reasons when we started doing this on my show on Wednesday nights, which has now become a staple. You know, at first, the audience, like, why is Rick Hunger there? I mean, come on, I don't want to hear from Rick. Oh, I like to get outside the echo chamber. Rick came on. We started talking. We started flushing out ideas. Rick's actually come up with some solutions that are very conservative. What were we talking about one day with dealing with licensing?
Yes.
I forget what it was, and I said, we're going to name a law after Rick, and it's a conservative
law.
Your career will be over, but it's going to be a great law. It's going to be huge.
You're killing me. Now, look, for me, and everything I've done, I work at Newsmax TV, which is conservative as it gets. I was at Fox before that. For me to
Forbes.
Forbes.
You still write at Forbes.
For me to go work at MSNBC, let's say, and I love MSNBC, but I sit around and I go, yeah, and yeah, and that's no fun.
Notice he works at really good, successful, conservative outlets.
Right.
Yeah. Does that tell you something?
It's more fun.
Well, you know,
it's
if you had a job at the New Republic, you would have had to quit and protest.
That's right.
And then, you know, I mean, like, it's good to have those some stability in your career.
I like doing your show. I like going places where I don't belong because the hope is maybe you reach somebody who doesn't see it the same way as I do, but they know, hey, you can still listen to me. You can still talk to me. You may come away still disagreeing, and maybe I'll convince you on something every now and then.
But, you know, there's something you just said, and I want to kind of alter that. When you said where you don't belong. In America, we actually
we all belong
in each other's courtyard, so to speak. It's how we work as a country, the difference, the marketplace of ideas.
Yep.
You know, you and I cover a range of topics. Cam does the same thing. It's not, you know, if you've got somebody who's got an angle on the Second Amendment, as we talked about last time, you bring them on.
Right.
Rick and I take on topics and we find, okay, how would I approach it? How would you approach it? Which one has the potential for success?
Well, and I think, too, you know, when you look at a lot of the issues that are sort of emerging issues now, there isn't necessarily a traditional right-left breakdown. I mean, you look at criminal justice reform, for instance.
It's not liberal. It's not conservative.
Right. You know, the word common sense gets thrown around way too much, particularly by anti-gun groups proposing laws that have no common sense whatsoever. But there really are some, I think, common sense things that we can accomplish in various areas. And you are starting, I think, to see that where, okay, yeah, you know what, we are going to disagree over here. But we also do agree, right, that maybe we've got an issue with our criminal justice system, and we might not even all agree on what the biggest problem is, but we can recognize there's a problem. I for one thing, you know, I think that's a problem that with 97% of our felony cases are plea bargained down.
Right.
I think it's a problem that we have apparently not enough space for violent criminals, and we want to add more laws on the books.
Well, that's because we're wasting it on nonviolent criminals.
Exactly. So, you know, I think that there are, and again, this has nothing to do with a gun control law.
Right.
But this is an issue that can impact Americans, you know, from coast to coast.
But you're putting your finger on the point, and the point is we're all supposed to have the same goal, make America better when we're talking about politics. David may have one way of doing that. I may have another way of doing it. It doesn't change the fact we're trying to do the same thing. So if you listen to these two sides of doing something and you shut up for every now and then and you actually listen to the other side, you go, that's not a terrible idea. And you start to see where do you craft something, not that,
that
makes liberals happy or makes conservatives happy, but solves the problem.
Yeah. Well, and that's, again, you know, problem solving versus position
argument.
Stating and arguing,
right.
I think, is, you know, one of the big problems that we have here. And I think it's why, in some regard, you have the media held in such low esteem.
Well, sure.
Why Congress is
it's
held
showbiz.
In such low esteem.
It's not news.
It's political theater,
well,
right?
But
I like the fact that, you know, you, David, and you, Rick, and Michael Steele, and really a lot of the shows on Sirius XM, a lot of the politics channels.
Yeah.
And I say this sincerely as somebody who listens on my way home, on my way to work every morning when I'm making the 3-hour drive from Farmville to D.C., I'm listening to the politics channels on Sirius XM. And I think that you know, again, maybe it's the format. Maybe you can spend a little bit more time doing it. But I think we are doing a pretty good job of getting beyond the silly talking points.
Hopefully.
I hope so, too, because I think that's what Americans want. They're tired of the theater. They want authenticity.
Right.
I think this is why Bernie Sanders is so popular, frankly.
I completely agree.
He's a socialist, and maybe his supporters don't want to really talk about what being a democratic socialist means, but at least he'll tell you,
I'm
a democratic socialist.
They're actually, to their credit, and I really don't support Bernie Sanders, but they're looking past the labels, mainly because his supporters don't know what it means. They're young, right?
Right, yeah. There is a little bit of a willful ignorance.
But they're looking past it to him because of what you say. He's willing to have an honest conversation with them.
Well, he has
clarity.
He has clarity. Yeah. Again, I tell you what, if somebody told me Bernie Sanders said the bathroom was over there, I'd go over there. The guy's wrong on everything.
He would tell you that we have too many toilet paper brands in this country.
And we should all use one
thing. The bathroom is open-minded.
But
you didn't even try the bathroom over there. How do you know
there isn't a bathroom over there? It's a bush. Anyway, but the
point. What do you got against bushes?
Nothing.
Is this a conservative position? Are you now anti-Bush?
I voted for him twice.
You think he was a liar?
No, but my point with this is, for his supporters, he's got clarity. and he projects that clarity for them. We can disagree with him, but at least he says to them, this is what I believe in. This is where I'm going. You know what you're getting with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that's something that's needed. Look, Rick brought up a point of how do we get down to solutions in this country. You've talked about it. You know, we have different lanes. And if you think about a highway, they all lead to some point, a destination. The problem is people don't think we can travel in the left lane, the middle lane, the right lane, towards the same destination and figure it out. We've got to really travel these different lanes, find out which is successful.
You know, I got to say this. I feel like we're doing a sports show.
Right.
The way we're set up here. Can I talk about Ohio State for a while?
Mm.
I knew it. I did it for him.
Where's the Michigan fans out there?
Here he's such a nice guy, but he's such an idiot because he's from Michigan. Forget politics. What is wrong with you, Larry?
Rick Unger, the co-host of Steele and Unger. When can we catch the show on POTUS, Rick?
Show is Monday through Friday, 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock Eastern time. And it's on POTUS 124.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming on the program. It is a pleasure to actually meet you in
person. I know,
you
too.
Hope we can do this again soon,
always,
sir.
Always, happy to.
Keep him in line when he's on your show.
Yeah, right.
I have to kick him out of my chair every day to get in and do my
show. True. He comes in right after.
I didn't realize part of the deal of giving him 5 days a week was that I had to put up with him 5 days a week.
And I try and leave all kinds of disgusting things around for when he comes in because there's no time for him to clean it up. You know, use Kleenexes and stuff.
I used to leave you pizza.
You did.
Pictures of pretty girls, and you leave me dirty
when
Kleenex.
We were doing the show on Saturday mornings,
yeah.
I'd come in every Saturday morning, and David would have had pizza the night before, and he'd leave me the box of pizza and a nice note. It was like having your mother be
exactly.
in the studio before
little
you.
A little mint on the keyboard.
Yeah. He laid out my clothes for the morning. It was awesome, you know?
Rick, listen, it's always a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much.
See you again.
Yeah, Rick, do I get my free gun now?
The bullet's on the way.
Shoot. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we come back, David Webb is going to stick with us. Larry O'Connor from WMAL in Washington, D.C. is going to join us on the program as well. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, and our on-location sponsor, Adcore Defense, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Jeff Gorman, he's an MP in Australia and also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party Victoria. Welcome, sir, to NRA News.
Thank you.
And welcome to the States.
Thank you. I've been enjoying my nearly 3 weeks now. It's an awesome country. I've only managed to fire a gun once whilst I've been here in the 3 weeks. It's been more or less work.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, you got to have take a little time to shoot. So tell us, Jeff, it's great we saw you here and we grabbed you because let's talk about what's happening down in Australia. What's the latest on the fight for gun owners' rights down there?
Well, as you're aware, the current administration here has been using Australia as a poster child.
I noticed that, yes. Yeah.
So I'm here telling people that all is not what it seems. It's a case of we have all these restrictions in Australia and their public safety value is actually dubious at the best.
Okay. Give us for instance.
Well, we have classifications of rifles. In 1996, we had a massacre in Tasmania.
Right.
And as a result of that, there was what was called the National Firearms Agreement was forced upon the states. Now, that classifies firearms into different sorts of firearms. A and B category are the normal sort of bolt actions and pump action rifles and
right.
the usual sort of stuff. C category is for .22 semi-automatics and some centerfire rifles. And D category is for all the evil black rifles and
yes.
and so on.
They're so evil.
Now, with the B category, which is the general sort of centerfire thing, you can get pump action rifles, which is fine. But if the pump action rifle looks like an AR-15, for instance, it gets reclassified to the D category, which is all but impossible for a normal person to have. So it looks apparently kill.
Well, Jeff, the devil's in the details, and the bureaucrats Indeed. Really run the world because they, with the paperwork and the machinations, they can make what seemingly innocuous regulations, Jeff, be very much not so.
Yeah, and that's the point I'm trying to bring. First of all, I mean, for our politicians is, if there's no actual public safety outcome to it, why are we doing it? I mean, I've been a policeman in Australia before, in Victoria. I understand the need for, in our country, some rules that may or may not apply here. I'm not here to tell you how to run your country. But reclassifying a firearm based on its looks, because apparently that's bad. I mean, there is no actual reason for that except an ideological push to get rid of firearms.
Speaking with Jeff Borman, he's an MP down in Australia. He's also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party of Victoria. All right, Jeff, so let's recap so far, because I have more I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
All the stuff that the current administration is going around touting about how great everything is in Australia with gun laws, not exactly true.
No. Well, let's also, another thing they talk about, the theft of firearms from legitimate owners feeding the black market.
Right.
And they've also coined a term called the grey market, which is for firearms that weren't handed back in 1996.
Okay.
But that's just a cynical way of trying to tie the law-abiding people into the criminals, because what they're saying is these people just didn't hand in these guns. So they're either black or white, as far as I'm concerned. It's either legal or illegal. Right. There is no grey market.
Right. A legal gun is an illegal gun.
Yeah.
Right.
So, look, and effectively, the trying to use us as a poster child for gun control is just, it's unbelievable. The mainstream media, of course, don't want to have a bar of us. They don't want to have that discussion.
No.
Because we bring a narrative that completely opposes what they say.
It's easier for them just not to talk to you.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, I got to say, I haven't had the mainstream media beating down my door to put me on some of these shows where they talk about gun control. But maybe my invitation got lost in the mail.
Yeah, perhaps. Spam email or something like that.
Well, you just can't tell.
Yeah. So what's your reaction? You've been up here in the States in a few weeks. What's been your reaction from folks up here to what you have to say?
It's been fantastic. I'm finding a lot of people, so they'll say to me, oh, look, they'll get my guns over my cold, dead hands and the Second Amendment and so on. But I also point out, people that come to these shows and the Dallas Safari Club convention where I was, they're law-abiding people, they're good people, they put into society. I ask them, do you really want to shoot a policeman that comes to your door to get your guns, or do you want to get shot by them and all this sort of thing? And I think the message I bring from that is, don't rely on the Second Amendment as such. You need to get yourself registered to vote, and you need to punish the people that are trying to take your guns away from you when you've done nothing wrong in the ballot box. And that way you avoid the whole problem.
Almost out of time. Just want to thank you, sir, for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us here on NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming to you from CPAC 2016. Our on-location sponsor, Adcor Defense. Coming up, top of the hour, Charles Cook of National Review sitting in as our guest co-host, Nick Adams, author of the brand-new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. Tony Katz from Tony Katz in the Morning News will be with us.
That was Tony.
That was,
that
in
was
fact.
Tony.
That was Tony. That was Tony and his one listener.
He's always been very shy.
There is already a long line of people who have come up to me and said, when Tony is on, I'm going to be coming here and messing with him.
yes.
So that's how you know that people love
that
Mr. Katz right there.
Back. And if you think that's an invitation, it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't mess with Cam. I'll back him up. Yeah. That's with Tony.
David Webb, host of the David Webb Show, is with us here on Sirius XM Patriot. And we've got Larry O'Connor from WMAL. Washington.
Good day, Cam. How are
you?
And Company. Good to see you, Company.
It's been a while.
It's good to see you, man. And I got to tell you, you're everywhere now. I mean, this
like
is
the plague. Yeah. It's. I'm sorry about that, by the way.
You're morning, your nights in Washington, D.C., right? Morning and drive.
We got morning drive and afternoon drive, which
God
is
God bless
weird
you, by
thing.
The way.
It's
as
only 1 hour in the afternoon.
Morning. You know, there is a cure for that.
Yeah, unemployment.
Yeah.
But you used to do the grind, Cam.
I did. The worst that I had was I had a morning sports talk show.
Yeah.
And then I worked making documentaries after I got off the air. So I was like kind of the two full-time jobs. And then I switched over to mornings news talk. But I never did the afternoon drive in addition to morning drive.
Yeah. I live close to the studio and I take a nap. That's the only
that's how you
although
do it.
The drawback is, because it's in the studio's in Washington, D.C., and the only way I can live close is to live in Maryland. So I have abandoned my Second Amendment rights for a while just so I can stay on the radio.
And isn't that
kind of
sad?
It's incredibly sad.
You sacrificing for your craft.
Listen, my wife is from Oklahoma, and she has never lived a day of her life without a gun in the house until she had to move to Maryland. She keeps saying, is there any way we can be in Virginia and still make it? I'm like,
yeah,
right, really.
Not well, there's a tent right there on the Potomac.
State of Maryland.
Yeah.
Ask Chris
I guess
Van
I could. Yeah, thank you, Chris Van Hollen. He's my congressman.
I feel for you. I really do. I mean, we moved here in 2004. My wife wanted to live in D.C., And I knew that wasn't going to happen, but I said, well, sure, we'll go do a drive, you know.
Yeah.
And we spent probably 30 minutes in the Kalorama neighborhood. And it was 2004, and there were all kinds of, I think it was Kerry signs at the time, already up in the windows, and we're driving around. And I said, and by the way, we're going to have to figure out a way to send all of our kids to private school. And, oh, yeah, by the way, can't own a gun. And, oh, yeah, by the way,
by the
she's
way.
Like, all right, enough,
yeah.
enough.
Commonwealth you know, is looking good now.
You had right? me at can't own.
But the sad thing is, I mean, you talk about Maryland. I was just up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania at the Great American Outdoor Show, and there were a ton of people from Maryland who were there in attendance.
Yep.
You know, the gun laws changed a couple of years ago. It's not like the gun owners changed. It's not like right. Maryland residents changed.
Right.
You know, frankly, the only thing that has changed since then is that the homicide rate in Baltimore has gone up.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And a mayor who stands by and says, yeah, we got to let them vent. Let's let them vent.
Yeah, Stephanie Rawlins-Blake.
That's always good, isn't it?
Yeah. But you know something about Maryland that people don't think about? You get out of Maryland, out of Baltimore, rather.
Out of Baltimore and out of Montgomery County.
And you move out into the outer areas, and it's a lot like New York State, a lot like of other places. Mm-hmm. You have what I call regular cross-section of Americans.
Right.
You know, they want their rights. I remember we were going to my cousin's wedding at a winery somewhere out in the center of the state and just walking down the street in what you would think is Maryland liberal. I run into a guy. He's like, man, you're on the Patriot Channel. You're on Fox. And by the time I'm done, there's a little crowd gathering.
Yep.
And I'm like, I go, what is this? He goes, we're all strong Republicans in this neighborhood.
That's true.
They exist, you know, yeah. and they believe in the same rights that we talk about. But the state gets ruled by these urban centers. And that's something we really need to fix because these are urban blights. These are the victim of liberal policies. Baltimore for 40 years. Martin O'Malley, the former governor, he wanted to be tough on crime. He ended up with his policies rounding up 20% of the population in Baltimore so he could run for governor.
That's right.
I mean, we've got to look at these liberal policies that have torn these cities apart. And when Freddie Gray, you know, plays out, you have to go back to Martin O'Malley, who broke the trust with the community.
That's right. An objective person would look at Martin O'Malley as mayor of Baltimore and look at his policies and say, well, these are racist policies.
Well, he was sued. He was taken to court by the very establishment that's there, you know, leading the protests in the Freddie Gray case, and nobody's holding the accountable person who caused this.
You know, and here's the thing. At the end of his tenure, I mean, he ran as Mr. Gun Control, right? And oddly enough, that wasn't a winning message, even for the Democrats.
That's right.
As a presidential candidate. But by the time that he left the mayor's office, Baltimore had, I think, the third or fourth highest per capita homicide rate in the country. This is after there
right.
were 100,000 arrests in 1 year. This is after he decided we can arrest our way out of this problem. No, you can't. By targeting, you know, by throwing this blanket over as many people as possible,
right.
this net of laws, and we're going to maybe, you know, reel in a couple of bad guys along with a bunch of innocent people who aren't violent criminals. How on earth do we think that this is going to work at this point in time? I mean, we're seeing this in D.C. right now.
Yes, we are. And you got to be encouraged by some of the voices that are kind of starting to come out. And I was hoping Rand Paul would stay in the race for a while because he was actually pushing that issue in a very heroic way. But, you know, now we have a Republican governor, Larry Hogan, in Maryland, and a lot of it was because of pushback against those very policies.
And you know what didn't happen to what you talk about, just throwing this blanket over it? They never tackled the fundamental problem. You know, there were simple things like making the neighborhood safer with community policing. I'm talking real community
right.
policing, not cops walking around playing, handshake managers and whatever,
yeah.
but actually going in and working to learn the community. You know who are the victims of crime? The very people in that community. You didn't build that bond with them. You didn't show them that law enforcement was a part of making them safer. The grandmother who wants to walk down to the CVS and get her prescription and doesn't want to be mugged. The guy who wants to close his store, his little bodega, and go home. Or the business that then,
right.
this is part of the problem with the urban blight issue in Baltimore, the business that wants to open and hire people but has a bad foundation of workforce or maybe non-existent workforce and people who don't want to travel in and work there.
You know,
it's a bad neighborhood.
There are too many small-handed Republicans who aren't feeling emboldened enough to go into the communities and actually talk about our values, talk about our principles, talk about constitutional principles that transcend race, transcend poverty, transcend everything because
fact,
they're not
transcend
based on
politics.
Yes.
If you think about it, go back to the Constitution. The Constitution wasn't set up to be the Republican Constitution. It's the United States Constitution.
Right.
So why don't we go in and talk to these people about how their rights need to be upheld and their opportunity, which is the American dream is opportunity. That's where it starts.
Can I just point out that you let me get away with small-handed Republicans? And didn't
it's
thank you.
It's going to be huge.
There's a lot of small-handed Republicans out here, I got to say. That's why he's not coming tomorrow.
Larry O'Connor is with us from WMAL and David Webb, host of the David yeah, Webb Show.
Thanks for throwing the radio station's call letters right after that.
There you go. I think that stands for it. Never mind. But, you know, so we had Ed Morrissey on the program last hour. He's got the new book, Going Red, coming out. And he was talking about this. But, you know, in addition to going into these communities and feeling like you are, like feeling emboldened enough to actually go and present your message, isn't a lot of it going to these communities and saying, rather than me talk, I want to listen.
Mm, yes.
I want to listen to you. Because a lot of times, what is the common, like, liberal complaint from the media is that Republicans don't care about you.
Right.
So if you go into these communities and you say, listen, message, I care, I think that comes off as very inauthentic. I think you show that you care by going into those communities and saying, all right, listen, I want to understand what is important to you.
Yeah.
I want to understand.
Or what you care about.
Well,
right.
Well, let's look at a failed Republican program, and I know that there are a lot that support this. Over the years, they came up with the Get Out the Vote program.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the program was Republicans went into communities, even knocked on the door and said, let me tell you why you should vote for a Republican. The conversation should have started where you are. What matters to you? What do you care about? How do we address your issues? And if I show you how I can address your issues, then let me ask for your vote.
Yep.
And I show you results. But this is the Republican push, the forcing of a vote. And what do politicians want, Larry? And I know you've complained about this over the years, is they
money
want
and your, sex, I
they
think.
Want, well, that's
or have I been in this
belly.
Town too long?
But what do they want? They want your vote. That's all they want in the end, most of them. I won't say every one of them, but it's all they want, most of them.
Yeah, yeah. If I can even take it one step before, because think about what you guys just said. You know, they need to go into the communities and they need to listen. Or they need to go into the communities and say, tell me what the situation is. I think part of the problem is that they are having to go into the community. Why do they have to go into the community? Why aren't they already in the community? Why aren't they actually putting their businesses in the community? Why aren't conservatives, why aren't businessmen? There's a reason why, of course there is, but if they can show how free enterprise, how the free market, how entrepreneurship can actually lift up a community, how the businesses can actually help the culture in a neighborhood, instead of going into the community, they should already be in the community.
Well, you know,
and they should be representing what they
can
do.
Part of that is, I think, in sync, and it's none of these things are what goes first or second, but in sync. So if you think about it, to your point, if you have advocates in that community, you have people that live in that community, that go to the churches, that shop, that own a business, and you talk to them, and you let them become your kind of, I call it your insurgents.
And they are there,
they
David.
Are,
I know you know them,
there.
And I know that you talk to
right.
them. They're
it's,
there.
I remember going into a pretty liberal area in Jersey City, New Jersey,
oh, yes.
to a Chinese restaurant. And I got to know the owner. It happened to be a great place, let me tell you.
Is
I
it the one
it.
On Grove Street? Right by
no,
Newark?
this one's on Montgomery Street, Shanghai Best.
Do you ever go there?
And I started talking to this gentleman, Alan, who owns it, right? And Alan and his business partners, here's a great example of Republican failure. Alan and his business partners have five businesses in the downtown Jersey City area, which has become a very nice area. I live there now. He started talking to me about business and interests and other things. One of his managers walks out. She goes, oh, David Webb. And, you know, with a heavy Chinese accent. And she goes, I watch you every day that I can. She goes, and I look back, and there's a TV back there by the employees, and they have Fox Business on.
There you go.
Because they're business people. They say, oh, we watch Fox News, too. And I go to their other restaurant because they invited me to go try the Thai place.
Mm-hmm.
I walk in, and I look back, and they're watching us. These are business people with the same ideals, the same shared businesses. And I talked to the Republicans in that town, including a good friend of mine. I said, have you ever talked to this person or this group of business owners?
Right.
They said, no, we didn't even know they existed.
Didn't know they were
they
there.
Own five businesses within a half a mile of you.
And they didn't even know that they were there.
That's the problem.
If I can find them.
But that's the thing. You've got to be looking. If you walk around with your eyes open and you walk around
that's
looking
exactly
for
it.
That, then you find these individuals everywhere.
Yeah, the problem is I think the Democrats have done such a good job.
Except of maybe Tacoma Park.
Appealing. That's true.
Right. Yeah.
People's Republic. The Democrats have done a good job of looking at all of these groups as groups, not as individuals that own businesses and have stories, but groups. And the group's leaders play the political game very well. And they can make a handshake and have a cash transaction, and they've got that group's support. So Republicans have seen that. And, you know, in business, you replicate what works, right? That gets rewarded, gets replicated. And so Republicans say, oh, so that's how you do it. No, that's how Democrats do it.
Well,
that's
so,
how unions do it, but that isn't how Republicans do it.
You know what else has happened in our political system? We have been carved up into red states, blue states. We have been carved up into Democrat counties, Republican counties. We've been districted, and it is the fault of both parties, because last time I checked, if I move from this county to this county, and one's red and one's blue, I don't have to change my political registration. But yet that's been sewn into the fabric of this nation that, you know, this county and this state, you don't go there. So what does the party do? They say, why don't we work to keep the ones where we are and solidify them?
Well, because their job is self-preservation.
Right.
That's right.
Back to self-preservation, back to just getting the vote.
Well, and this, again, I think explains a lot of the voter discontent in this country, what we're seeing it on both sides of the aisle, and, of course, that vast, muddied middle where, you know, we've seen more and more independents. This is not a new phenomenon. We've seen people, you know, dropping the party labels for a long time, and I think now we're seeing this play out in a way that we never have, or at least not in our lifetime.
Well, actually, there's a key moment here to go to your point, Cam. I call it the 40-year political itch. The millennial generation, no, this is a 40-year change.
Yeah.
Look at political cycles. You know, politicians look at things in election cycles, 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, whatever the case may be. Look at the country over decades. We're in that 40-year itch period where we've got a change in generation, a change in economy, a change in technology, a change in culture, and a change in global affairs.
Yeah.
And this is why people are saying, hang on a second. I'm new to this, or this is a new dynamic, and you're working in the old school dynamic, and that doesn't work. So this disconnect is what's going on, and I urge people to look longer when they address this issue.
And 40 years ago, Hillary Clinton was still too old to be president.
Larry O'Connor, you can check him out.
That was gratuitous.
All the time on WMAL, mornings, afternoons.
Yes.
Good thank to see you, sir. It's always
and IndependentJournalReview.com. Check
there
us out at GoodShow.com.
David Webb, right. 9 p.m. Eastern on SiriusXM Patriot 125, all over Fox and Fox Business. Thank you, sir.
Always great to see you, my brother.
We'll
Cam
see you soon. Hour 3 is coming up right after this.
We're here at the NRA World Shooting Championship here at Peacemaker National Training Center in beautiful West Virginia. And Gabby Franco is here with NRA News Tips and Tactics. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Oh, very good. Enjoying the competition and the toughness of the competition, too. It's challenging.
Well, we just saw you out there on the line, and it is a little nerve-wracking being out there, and they're calling out, you know, different combinations of patterns, and you're like, you know, hunting around. But let's talk a little bit about tips and tactics first. Tell folks who don't know, what's it all about?
Well, the good thing about tips and tactics is that we bring a lot of great instructors who are expert in certain things like hunting, defensive, or just target shooting. And then they explain to us what is it they do and how they do it so well. And I feel honored to be a host for this show. I really love to hear these great instructors and actually put my input into it, even though I may not be an expert on their in their field. But there's so many things that we relate to that I can say, you know what, this is what I do as a competitive shooter or as a accuracy or something like that. So it is definitely for men and women who ever wants to watch and learn. Hey, just make sure that you tune in.
And Gabby, a great thing about that is we're all about keeping the shooting sports, hunting, everything healthy, vibrant, getting new people coming. And a lot of people need that kind of information. They're not all experts like folks around here are. The tips and tactics is really practical stuff for them.
Let me tell you something about being an expert, okay? This competition shows you, it really humbles you. It's like, you know what, I'm good in pistol shooting, but I come here to shotgun and I barely know how to shoot that. And I try to do my best and learn from it. And I love that. And that's what I tell people. Don't hesitate on going to a competition just because you don't know. That's how we learn. And the moment you say, I'm not going to go, you're limiting yourself. And at the end, that's not good.
And if you don't try it, how do you ever know how you're going to do?
Exactly. And like yesterday, I had a lot of things with Bianchi Cup. I've never shot that before. This I've never shot before. And I was thinking to myself, what am I doing here? And then I said, you know what? There's so many things I'm learning now, not only about the sport and activities, but how to keep my mindset strong. It's like, you know what? I don't know about this. I'm going to do my best. The next one is the next. Leave that in the past and keep going, keep fighting and trying to do my best. Whatever is going to happen in the future, I don't have that. So I need to do my best. So
now you're wearing a Remington shirt. So let's talk about the importance, Gabby. We see it in all the other world of sports. It's important in shooting sports. How important is that relationship with you and your sponsor, Remington?
Well, one of the things I really love around Remington is that when they approached me, they told me, Gabby, what do you want to do? What do you want to achieve? We want to help you out to achieve that. And to me, that's priceless because these companies, they want not only us as a sponsor shooter, but everybody else to enjoy the sport safely, responsibly, and they're putting everything they can out there. And that's amazing.
All right. So what's your advice for someone who's out there? Because we talked off camera. You're a role model for so many different kind of young ladies and other people who want to get in the shooting sports. They see you out here doing it. What's your advice about trying this?
Well, just show up. Just go. Learn about the sport, whichever you want to go in and watch. But just go there, learn, and talk to people. What are the gear that you need? What are the things that you need to have in order to compete correctly? And then train. It's fun. Have fun first. My best advice. Have fun, learn, fail. And with the fail and all that, you're going to rise, and you're going to do great.
Gabby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now from CPAC 2016, the Conservative Political Action Conference, just downriver from Washington, D.C., at the Gaylord Convention Center. Coming on the program this hour, Mr. Charles Cook of National Review, going to be sitting in with us as our guest co-host, Nick Adams, author of the new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz of the Morning News, joins us on the program. I promise when things settle down and it is not the unorganized chaos that it is right now, we will return to our Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, and our Deal of the Day, and our Good Guy of the Day. In fact, we were just talking about the Good Guy segment because I want to welcome to the program right now the Executive Director of Americans in Support of Law Enforcement. Scott Erickson is with us. Scott, thank you, sir, for coming on the program.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, like I said, you know, this is something that we want to make sure our audience hears these stories every day of officers who are doing good things.
Sure.
And a lot of times, you know, it's big stuff, but a lot of times it's small stuff, too. It's those stories that, you know, they never get on the national news. They may not even always get on the local news, but a lot of times police departments, they'll share these stories on their Facebook pages or they'll promote it on Twitter. You know, officers coming to the aid of someone who ran out of gas, they didn't have enough money to put gas in their car, or
yeah,
they didn't have food, or there was a story we saw not long ago, somebody who had shoplifted a dozen eggs because they didn't have enough money to buy them, and they hadn't fed their kids in a day. And the officer thought, what am I going to really accomplish here by arresting this person, right? So we try to put that face on law enforcement officers. You know, protecting and serving the community means a lot of different things.
It certainly does. And you brought up one of the more well-known examples with the eggs and the shoplifting. But just last week, there was a photo on Facebook. I think it was in Texas. The Texas police officer kind of went viral. An officer who dealt with a homeless man. He was a homeless vet. And instead of just, you know, shooing the guy along and telling him to take off, he actually bought the guy with his own money a hotel room for the night.
Yep.
There's a lot of examples like that. Unfortunately, like you said, the mainstream media isn't really interested in promoting those ideas. They're more interested in promoting demagoguery. They're more interested in promoting division, inflammatory rhetoric that activist groups or politicians like to put out there. But those are the stories that really define the character of our law enforcement community in this country. And that's a big part of what our organization is attempting to do.
And so you are in law enforcement right now, right?
Yeah, I've been a police officer for over 18 years in California, second-generation police officer. And I founded this organization middle of last year. So now I have two full-time jobs.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what is, I mean, obviously the group Americans in Support of Law Enforcement, I guess that explains what the mission is. But what do you mean by supporting law enforcement?
Well, again, I think if you really boil it down, the big thing that's lacking in the public conversation on policing in America is context and perspective. We get one side of the issue usually, and over the past few years, that's typically been a very negative depiction of law enforcement. What we want to do is simply add context. We want to be out there and be a consistent voice that tells the public. It's a grassroots organization that we get together and we tell the public exactly what else could be going on. When you watch a situation, a YouTube video, what might have been going on in the officer's head? What policies could he have been following? What the other side of the story, essentially. This isn't about absolving every police officer of everything. It's not, you know, police officers are human beings. Human beings are fallible. So you're going to have people do bad things who are cops. But that doesn't define the character of law enforcement like the mainstream media would like us to believe or some of these activist groups would like us to believe. The real character is defined by the stories you mentioned earlier and by the stories that we promote on our website. That really gets to the heart of who the American cop is. The American police officer is a decent person trying to do the right thing to protect and serve his community or her community. And that institution deserves respect, and we need to refocus the conversation in that direction.
You know, I and it's fascinating because I think on the other side, we do have those Americans supporting law enforcement. We've had a couple of stories recently of individuals who have come to the aid of police officers, armed citizens. There was a veteran in Bastrop, Texas, who came to the aid of a sheriff's deputy who was being attacked. The guy had actually gotten on top of the deputy, was in the process of getting his gun. This concealed carry holder shot the attacker. There was a case out of Upper Darby Township, Pennsylvania, not long ago, where a officer was attacked by a couple of kids as he was trying, a couple of teenagers. He was trying to stop them fighting. All of a sudden, there's a crowd of 50 teenagers around this officer, and you know, a lawful gun owner came out of his house, didn't point the gun at anybody, had the gun by his side, but said, "You need to get away from this officer." And they were able to do so. So there's also that two-way street. When you talk about the support that law enforcement provides, there is that tangible support in those instances of Americans supporting law enforcement. But I think there's also the idea that really is present around this country of, okay, we have your back, right? We the American people, have the back of law enforcement. And again, it's not that we don't understand that sometimes there will be issues and legitimate issues. But you know, I've been lucky enough to know a lot of officers, and I've yet to meet one who decided that they wanted to make it their life's mission to terrorize a community to get paid to do it. You know, like, exactly. I just don't see that, and I don't see how somebody who's made that their mission is going to last very long in a department without their fellow officers speaking up and speaking out against that type of behavior.
Exactly. You know, if there were somebody like that, that person would be very unlikely that they would ever get through the background process, the hiring process, the application process. You know, municipalities and local police departments go to great lengths to make sure they're hiring the best quality individuals that they can. There's a lot at stake, public trust not being the least of it. So those folks are rare if they do exist, and they certainly, like I said, don't represent the overall character of law enforcement like some people would like us to believe. But look, the American public by and large supports law enforcement. We believe that. I know that. And Gallup did a poll last year that even in the midst of all of this anti-police hysteria, law enforcement still ranked third in terms of most respected institutions in America behind the military and small business owners. So the overwhelming majority, if you will, the silent majority out there who does respect law enforcement and understands the hard work that the police officers do every day, we just want to make sure that those folks are provided the right kind of intellectual ammunition, in essence, to be able to combat a lot of the anti-police rhetoric that's out there.
What do you think about, are there policy changes that could be undertaken that would maybe, you know, improve things? When you talk about maybe the disconnect between the community and the law enforcement, you know, that's supposed to be there serving that community, is that an issue? And what can be done to start to repair that damage so that we're not talking past one another and we're not... Yeah. You know, we're actually able to see each other's side,
sure,
or at least see each other as individuals on these sides.
You know, the concept of community policing, it's been around a long time. It's nothing new. But over the past 10 years, as a result of budget cuts throughout the country and throughout municipalities, a lot of programs within local police departments have had to be scaled down. And oftentimes, because it's not considered an essential element of a police department's function, whether it's patrol or investigative duties, you'll see, you know, public outreach, community policing programs getting cut back. That really is important. It goes a long way in not just building the bridges between the community and law enforcement, but creating a sense of trust between the two parties and ownership within the public with their police department. So that, I think, could go a long way if police departments recognize that It's important to engage the community. It's important to establish good working relationships with the people that they serve and make sure that, that appropriate resources are put toward that. Now, obviously, it's very difficult, and, you know, we all wish we had more resources, but at the end of the day, that can't be overlooked.
But, you know, that's actually an important point. I mean, we are dealing with finite resources, and so you do have to prioritize what's going to be important to you. And I don't know how comfortable you are talking about the gun control issue, but this to me is one of the fundamental disconnects from anti-gun activists that say, well, what we need is another law, and we need another law, we need another law.
Sure.
And we talked with sheriffs in Oregon right after the universal background check law was implemented there. And one of the sheriffs that we talked to said, look, I don't really support the law, but more than that, I don't know how I'm supposed to actually enforce this because we don't have enough money in our budget to put deputies on the streets 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, we have 20 hours a day coverage,
sure.
And if there's a car accident at 2 o'clock in the morning, a deputy has to get up and drive out from their house. He said, we have the budget right now to investigate crimes of violence against persons.
Yeah.
That's what we've got the money to budget for, you know, or to investigate for. In Oakland, California, this goes back 2 or 3 years now. If you're the victim of a burglary,
sure.
The police said, we can't come out. You know, go to the police department, go to your local police department, fill out a report, let us know what's gone missing. But, you know, CSI is not coming out to dust for prints or anything like that. They don't have the money. So we've got to start prioritizing what it is that we are focusing on. And it seems to me if we're focusing on violent crime and trying to drive down violent crime, the focus will be on the violent criminals that we know are out there, the repeat offenders, the ones who have that rap sheet as long as your arm.
Yeah, exactly. The problem in our society is not a lack of laws. It's a lack of willingness within the criminal justice system at large to enforce the laws that need to be enforced. When we have a revolving door, essentially, within the criminal justice system where people are arrested 10, 20, 30, 40 times for the same crime, and then we all put our hands up and we're confused about why the person then just went and shot somebody, there's a reason. You know, we're not enforcing the law. We're not imposing any accountability within society, within the criminal justice system. So,
and you're really seeing that in California over the last few years.
Sure, and California's decriminalized a lot of what used to be felonies, a lot of drug possession, which used to be felonies, are now misdemeanors. A lot of people, essentially purging the prison system of inmates. And those folks, you know, who have not been given appropriate or tangible skills to be able to reintegrate into society, what are they going to do? And it's very high likelihood they're going to go back and commit crimes doing the things that they were doing. So California is a good example of what not to do in that sense. But again, it's not that we need new laws. It's that we need to enforce the right laws on the right people who commit violent crimes.
Absolutely. We're talking again with Scott Erickson, the Executive Director of Americans in Support of Law Enforcement. What's the website, Scott?
The website's supportingcops.org. So it's pretty easy to remember, supportingcops.org. We love your support. We'd love anyone to sign up for our newsletter. Just get involved. Take a look at what we're doing. We'd love feedback as well.
And what can we do in our communities? I mean, what can we just as Americans do to help further that mission?
You know, I think in a very easy way in your day-to-day life, if you see a police officer, just for a second, remember exactly what that person, he or she, is going through and what they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. It's, you know, you might see a police officer sitting and having coffee and thinking that that's all they do. Well, it's not all they do. And that's the luxury to be able to sit down and actually relax for a few minutes. But even if they're in public having a cup of coffee, believe me, the average police officer is still looking over their shoulder. They have to be aware of their surroundings. It's a tough job physically and even more so mentally. So just be cognizant of that. And if you have a second, shake his or her hand and say thank you.
Well, listen, Scott, I'm going to do that right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
For what you do. And it's a real pleasure getting a chance to talk with you. I hope we can do this again, sir.
That'd be great.
Absolutely. Enjoy the rest of CPAC.
Thanks a lot.
You bet. Scott Erickson joined us, the Executive Director, again, of Americans in Support of Law Enforcement. I know it's a couple minutes early, but let's go ahead and take a timeout. When we come back here on NRA News, Cam & Company from CPAC 2016, Charles Cook from National Review is going to join us. Nick Adams is a new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. Tony Katz is going to join us. We also have Chris Lash standing over there. Hey, Chris. We've got Andrew Langer, who just walked away. I don't know what even that's about, but all right. All right, we'll stick around. You never know who's going to be showing up here on NRA News, Cam & Company, but we will be back right after this.
Speaking with David Helmer with NRA Field Ops, David talking about Youth Education Summit and
application process. First, quickly, what is it, Youth Education Summit?
Youth Education Summit is a week-long leadership week where we bring in 45 to 50 kids from across the country, and for seven really action-packed days where we learn about the American government, history, and the importance of the Second Amendment.
Okay, who's the typical person who can apply for this?
High school sophomores and juniors can apply, and you need to have at least a 3.0, and you need to be interested in affecting your government and really making a positive difference in your community.
Okay, so when does the application process run, and how do they do it?
We're accepting applications until February 1st, and what it takes is, again, you have to have at least a 3.0 and be a sophomore or junior. Then there's a three-page essay on the Second Amendment, a one-page personal statement where you tell us why you think we should accept you, three letters of recommendation, a page of all your extracurricular activities and awards, and then you also need to include your high school transcript.
Okay, so tell us, who is the typical kid who would apply for this and be part of this program? Give us an idea.
A lot of the kids are shooters. Some are very involved in the military or interested in the military, but it's not a requirement. Mainly it's kids that are leaders amongst their peers and just want to make a positive difference and learn about the government and what they can do to be an active citizen.
So I guess you got to be interested not only in the Second Amendment, but getting involved and making a difference here and getting to know how things work here in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, they get to see a little more of the political process at work. We spend a day where we go downtown and to the Capitol. We meet a congressman, and we even get to sometimes go into the House and Senate galleries, so they see the political process and work.
How do they get more information about applying?
For more information, you can go to friendsofnra.org/yes, or you can email yes@nrahq.org.
All right. David Helmer, NRA Field Ops. Get those applications in. Thank you for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks.
I was born in Greece in 1939. Nazi warplanes bombed us unmercifully. Executions in the streets were common. I saw horror you could never imagine. Human beings became animals, starving and desperate. But me, I was lucky. Soon after the war, I saw the Statue of Liberty, and I cried. I've been blessed by the freedom and opportunity only America can offer. Today, I feel a duty to speak out. There will always be evil in this world, but the one thing that separates America from every other country is our freedom. And the one freedom that protects all the others is our Second Amendment. Never give it up. Never. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
We don't rise up to the occasion, but instead fall back on our level of training.
Champions spend hours practicing for the smallest improvements.
In order not to be a victim, it's important that you have a plan.
That's the perfect time to take your shot.
I am Gabby Franco, and I'll see you next time in another episode of Tips and Tactics, sponsored by Cabela's Outdoor Fun.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. We are coming to you from CPAC 2016 at the Gaylord Convention Center National Harbor. You're looking live inside the ballroom there at the Conservative Political Action Conference. And live on set with us right now, I'm just going to shut up because we've got Charles Cook from National Review. Say hello, Charles.
Hello, how are you?
Hello, how are you? Listen, and then we've got Nick Adams joining us from a new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. How are you, Nick?
G'day, Cam Edwards.
Yeah, g'day, right? I mean, like, seriously, how can I compete with this? I can't even compete with this. Every time we have you, Charles, on the program, you don't even know what happens to my Twitter mentions and my emails. Oh, I love it when Charles comes on the show. I just love listening to Charles. You should just shut up, Cam, and just let him talk. And now it's like even worse because now we've got Nick with us as well. So thank you both, gentlemen. And it's not even your accents. It's what you have to say. I want you to understand that. It's what you have to say. It's your mind. It's your ideas.
No, it's the accent.
It is the accent. In addition
I'm full
to
of
the
it, actually.
Mind of the ideas. Well, listen, I appreciate both of you coming on the program. It is a real pleasure to see each of you in person here.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. This is not your first CPAC rodeo, is it?
It's my second.
Okay.
And you should remember that because I was on here last year with you.
I know that, yes.
But I think about it often. But obviously it was just from just
no,
me.
This was one of those questions, sort of the you know, hypothetical questions. I remember giving you Advil, actually, at last year's CPAC.
That's right. I suppose everyone doesn't know about that.
That's true. But you had a thumper of a headache. I feel bad for you. And Nick, is this your first CPAC?
This is my virgin experience.
Really?
This is my first inaugural CPAC. This is a day that will go down in history, cannabis. I am thrilled to be here. This is the greatest conference in the world. And
you say that only because you haven't been to the NRA annual meeting.
That's
yet.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. And I would never dare to blaspheme. But I'm looking forward to getting
back.
But
this is pretty cool. I will say this.
This is good.
This is up there.
This is good.
Do you have anything like this in Australia?
Absolutely
politics?
Not. Absolutely not. I mean, I'm sure Charles can weigh in about the mother country, but I can tell you that politics in Australia is very moribund. It is very boring. It does not have the colour or the excitement or the innovation or the passion that is attached here in American politics. And as a student and an observer of American politics for such a long time, for as long as I can remember, this really is like Disneyland. I mean, this is about as good as it gets. We have a collection of patriots here that are determined, that are on fire for America, and I can't think of anything better than that.
What is it, Nick, that got you so interested in the United States? Was there a moment when you realized, like, all right, I'm beyond simply unhappy with the way things are going in Australia?
Well, look, I think my very first word, Cam, was Coca-Cola. So that was probably a sign of things to
both
come.
Both of them or just one?
Yeah, that's right. But look, all my life, since a young boy, I was drawn to the United States. And I know it's something that's very difficult to explain. But it's not just me. There's lots of people like Charles and I put you in this same category. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Elon Musk.
I quite like him as
Stuart
well.
Stuart Varney, yes. Yeah. And
often in the same category, the Charles.
Yeah. But just for the muscles. Yeah.
Right, of course.
Just muscles.
Well, the accent, again,
yeah, well, he's got
accent.
Another good accent. Yeah. Now the Twitter feed's really going to blow
right.
up. But look, there is definitely something about the optimism, the vibrancy, the individualism, the existence, I think, of a still very strong faith in America that really makes it the place to be. I mean, this, Cam, is the place where magic happens. This is the country, I think, where initiative, risk, and confidence go further than anywhere else. And it's why, contrary to what you hear in the media, contrary to what the elite will preach, it's why more people want to come to America than want to go anywhere else.
So despite what the president says, maybe there's something there is something real about the idea of American exceptionalism. Not that the people are better, but that the place is better. The place is unique. The place is something different. Yeah.
Well, it is culture. I mean, it's not in the water,
right.
I think. It's not as if any constitution had been passed, America would have been to the moon in 1969. It's not foreordained, and I think that's the interesting point, that you have a constitutional order here that is built upon principles that are, at least initially, British, and played out in Australia to an extent, but have been lost and eroded. And America has not lost them yet, although many are trying. In a sense, you have here a far more intact and uncorrupted form of classical liberalism, which we call conservatism here, or libertarianism.
Or conservatarianism,
or available at all good bookstores. And that is extremely attractive if you believe in those things, but Nick and myself grew up in a country that had largely lost those values.
All right, so we've got running for the Democratic nomination a guy who calls himself a Democratic Socialist. Mm. And, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about what that means, and I've engaged briefly with some Sanders supporters, and they keep bringing up, like, Norway or, you know, Scandinavian countries. We don't want to be like Russia. We're not talking about Venezuela. We want to be like Norway. Mm. Explain to me, if America is freedom, and let's say North Korea is totalitarianism, where is Australia? Where is Great Britain on that spectrum? What is it? Is it like, because again, you don't have knocks on the door in the middle of the night and the secret police coming to take you away. But you mentioned a lack of energy in politics. Is it innervation? Is it apathy? Is it you don't fight because you know you can't win because your rights have disappeared so long ago?
Well, I think the rights have been blunted rather than disappear completely.
I
mean, you can still stand up on an upturned cart on the corner, mostly, and speak. There are some exceptions, of course. In fact, we do in England arrest people if they say the wrong thing on the upturned cart. But the average person speaking is not going to be in trouble. It's just that the point at which the rights become challenging, which is really any right should be challenging by definition, it's blunted and it's dulled. Now, of course, on a scale which ranges from the United States to North Korea, Britain and Australia are both much closer to the United States.
Right.
But you hear frequently this idea, especially when it comes to, say, speech, that, well, we have to balance offense and liberty. Well, there's
but
no
are
point in having
England
the right
college
there.
Campuses.
Well, exactly,
right,
and that's the great fear that it will spread here as well. But I think it's the same when it comes to the Second Amendment and the idea, well, you have a right not ever to be in harm's way. Well, I'm afraid that's not how rights work.
So this, I think, leads really well, Nick, to your new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, which, A, suggests that America needs to be retaken, that America has, in a sense, been lost, and perhaps again to those forces of political correctness that would say, Nick, you can't write that book. I'm offended. That's a microaggression. You've hurt my feelings, and you should be punished for that. Even if you didn't mean to hurt my feelings, you did, and you should be punished, sir.
Well, Cam, you know, the whole thing about political correctness is that it's not merely an imposition on speech. Political correctness, I think, transcends that. Political correctness is really a cultural mindset that has ripple effects throughout. So a country that subscribes, or a culture that subscribes to the totalitarian ideology of political correctness, because that's really what it is, it's intellectual tyranny, it's a choking conformity that strips individualism, removes confidence, eliminates your identity. A country or a culture that subscribes to that is really striving for mediocrity, not greatness. It is a country that is embracing the relative. It is a culture that says, well, we're no better than anybody else. And that's simply not the case.
We'll all be equally crummy.
Well, that's right. You know, I mean, all people are equal, but all cultures are not equal. And if you believe in everything, you believe in nothing. But yet, these are things that accompany moral clarity. And unfortunately, those things are conspicuously absent today. And it's disturbing. And it's terrible to see it happening in America, because nothing is more antithetical to the foundational principles of the United States than political correctness.
Yeah, and I think political correctness and censorship both imply a certain insecurity. Unless you are stopping somebody from speaking or arresting them for speaking because they are quite literally on the verge of hurting somebody, then you are essentially arguing that your culture is not strong enough to withstand a contrary opinion. And so that the person listening is likely, rather than to hew to the strong values on which the culture is based, is likely to become corrupted. And so when on a college campus you hear somebody say, we can't possibly let that person come and speak, even if the person in question is terrible, we can't possibly let that person speak because of what that might do to the environment, what you're really saying is our students are stupid. The idea that if we have a two-bit fascists come and speak at Harvard, that all of those students will start goose-stepping. It's suggesting that they are impressionable and dumb, and that the culture around them is weak. And I reject that.
As I would like to think a lot of college students would reject this idea. I mean, one of my favorite speeches by Charlton Heston was actually delivered at the Harvard Law School in 1999, and it was called Winning the Culture War. And he went to Harvard Law, and he said, listen, you, the cream of the crop here at Harvard University, the best and the brightest that this country has to offer, and you are cowards compared to your fathers, because you won't stand up to this stuff, and you are being silenced, and you are being told what to think, and you are being told what to say. And if you don't speak up, if you don't stand out, and he talked about his experience in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and he says, yeah, it hurts to disobey. It hurts to say, no, you will not tell me that I can't speak my mind. You will not tell me that I can't have this opinion. He said, you know, it absolutely can hurt, but if you don't do it, then it disappears forever.
Well, Cam, the people that are behind political correctness, the people that are really trying to force us into this self-silencing, this self-censorship, they are moral and intellectual Lilliputians. They are pixies that, as Charles rightly points out, are so insecure that they're trying to make their insecurity infectious. And the war on confidence, the war on American self-belief is so profound now. And I happen to think that self-belief is the engine of American exceptionalism. Americans have got to believe in themselves. And unfortunately, political correctness and this new green gay gospel that has emerged among the elites, the two litmus tests on whether or not you're allowed to enter polite society seem to be whether you support traditional marriage and whether you or not you subscribe to anthropogenic climate change. And if you're on the wrong side of either of those two, then all of a sudden you're persona non grata. And unfortunately, if you blaspheme against that green gay gospel, you're liable to lose your job, miss out on opportunities, get cancelled as a college speaker. And in so many ways, Cam, conservatives or people that hold these traditional ideas have become the new communists. It wasn't that long ago that if you were a communist or you had some association with communism, real or perceived, you were targeted. You lost your job. You missed out on opportunities. You were cancelled on a college campus. Boy, how the tables have turned.
If you will not bake a cake, if you will not, right, then you shouldn't have a job. You shouldn't have a livelihood.
I can't bake cakes, actually, so.
Well.
I wouldn't be particularly
then
useful.
Then you, sir, need to leave the country right now.
I could make an omelet.
All right, you can stay.
Thank you.
So you've spoken on some college campuses before.
I have.
Have you experienced this yourself? Or have you
no.
had mostly respected...
Mostly respectful. I think just before I answer that, one of the mistakes that we make on the free speech side of things is to talk about those who are being censored and ignore those who are being deprived of their right to listen. We only focus on one side of the equation. And so if somebody is disinvited from a college campus because they hold the wrong views or because they will somehow magically make all of the students unsafe by speaking, well, we say they're being censored, we say they're being shouted down, and that's right, they are, and that is a violation of their liberty and of their dignity, but it's also a considerable violation of those who want to hear them. When you silence somebody, you also silence those who wish to learn from them. And maybe one person is affected when a college campus cancels a speaker, at least in terms of who's receiving a paycheck. But actually, 100, 150, 200 people are affected because they're not granted the right to listen and make up their own mind. In terms of my appearances on college campuses, I've never had any protesters. I did have a protester at the Kansas City Public Library once.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
At the public library.
Yeah, but then she stormed out, and she was French, so of course she did. She surrendered before she'd even started. But college campuses, no. Although I do get silly questions sometimes about social justice, which I just ignore.
You just don't even.
Well, I just say I'm not interested in any of that.
And okay.
And can we talk about why I'm here?
And you know, Nick, you talked about the attempt to put people on the defensive.
Mm-hmm.
Charles, you know, saying, listen, I'm not here to talk about that. Let's talk about what I'm here to talk about. I mean, is one of the simplest ways of pushing back simply not allowing yourself to get defensive, saying, all right, you're perfectly entitled to your point of view, but I'm entitled to mine, and I'm going to keep talking. I'm going to keep saying what I believe.
Absolutely. Look, I guess every circumstance that presents itself needs to be dealt with in a different way according to its context. But I certainly think that we need to be bold. And one of the things that political correctness removes, as I say, is confidence. It removes a boldness. And without being bold, we miss out on a lot of things. And just to piggyback on what Charles was just speaking about in terms of those being deprived from listening, we do only focus on the other thing, and what we also don't focus on is all the books that have never been written
right.
because of political, all the plays that have never been, all the movies that were never made. We've already lost so much from this, and we don't even realize it. We're now focused on not losing any more, but
right.
we've already lost a lot.
Absolutely.
And so, look, we need to fight back. I mean, this is a bully, and how do you deal with a bully? You punch him in the nose, you hit first, you hit hard, and you don't stop.
Well, I think if somebody asks you an unintelligible and meaningless question, it's your responsibility to point that out and to refuse to answer it. I'm not talking about backing down when people ask good questions, and they very often do, and many of them, of course, come from the left, and they
sure.
come from exactly the culture we're critiquing. But there is a tendency to string nonsense words together. You see it in the abstracts of academic papers these days. Mm-hmm. And say absolutely nothing, nothing cogent whatsoever. I'm thinking of these questions, which are designed to shut down conversation, but really need to be exposed for the fluff that they are.
You know, that's interesting, because I think there are obviously many different ways to be bold. Right. I mean, there's Sam Kinison, the old stand-up comic. He was pretty bold, right? Gary Cooper was bold as well in High Noon. So, you know, there, you say different situations call for different responses.
Yeah, they do. Look,
but, and it also, I think, you know, no matter who you are, no matter what your personality type is, you don't have to be the biggest extrovert in the world.
No, you don't.
To stand up and be bold when you need to be.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think what we need to do, Cam, and what I outline in my book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, is that we need to begin employing the tactics of the left. We need to be engaged in the culture war. I think that when people don't like a particular television anchor or radio host, the immediate inclination is to simply change the dial or flip the remote. And while that's eminently understandable, I think in order to be able to defeat an enemy, you've got to know an enemy. You've got to understand the enemy. And we really need to... I mean, you can't win the football game by getting off at halftime. And I think,
unless you're winning at halftime.
Unless you're playing soccer, then you're not going to win at all. But look, it's so we need to engage in the culture war. We need to recapture the classrooms of elementary, middle, high schools, the lecture theatres of universities, the newsrooms in all the major cities, because this is where culture is being created. And they have developed this culture of complaint. They have engendered this victimhood movement. And it is terrible to see the great, proud country of the United States be afflicted by this collectivist, bureaucratic, relativist nonsense that is political correctness. You know, and the good news, I guess, Cam, is that as I have traveled throughout the United States, people are sick and tired of this stuff. They're sick and tired of being accused of microaggressing and macroaggressing and trigger warning and white privileging and not knowing the 97 different genders and being accused of racism if they dare to criticize President Obama or criticize Secretary of State Clinton. And we need to really stand up. We need to embrace the American virtue of boldness. We need to reclaim the territory.
The best response to a charge of a microaggression is to issue a micro-apology.
I'm sorry this much. All right, listen, Nick, we got to take a break. Unfortunately, I promise this is not anti-Australianism coming out, but we love talking to you on the program. Hold the book up so that we can see it. It's out now, right? People can order
it. You endorsed it.
It's right there on the back. Absolutely.
Came
Nick Adams, Retaking America.
Thank you
so much.
God
it's always a pleasure.
Brother.
Glad we got a chance to actually meet in person.
Looking forward to keeping on doing it.
Absolutely.
Be bold.
We've got more with them. We're going to be bold because we're keeping Charles Cook around for another segment, and that is a bold decision.
He's censoring you, but not me. I'm favored.
I'm Aussie aggressing. When we come back, Tony Katz, host of Tony Katz in the Morning News. On WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, the one-man fan club. He's the host and fan club all in one package. Stick around. We got more in our news camera company coming up, sponsored by Nosler and our on-location sponsor, AdCorps Defense, from CPAC 2016.
It's a tragedy that has struck a real nerve here in New Jersey and across this country. Carol Baum was ambushed and brutally stabbed to death right here in the front of her home by her ex-boyfriend, who was also a convicted felon. There's no question Carol feared for her life. She installed security cameras. She took out a restraining order. And she applied for a gun permit in April. But she was still waiting for that permit to be approved the night she was murdered. People here tell us this never should have happened, but that Carol was another victim left defenseless by the very system she relied on to protect her.
Romero, it's been awful.
My friend didn't have to die this way. He killed her like an animal. And I will never rest knowing that that's the way my friend's life was ended. Because she couldn't protect herself. And knowing that it could have been prevented makes it all that much more painful and hard to digest.
Absolutely, the system failed her. She did everything by the book. Everybody's outraged.
You feel helpless for that individual, a severe taste of disgust. This shouldn't have happened.
What do we have to do in this state? It's really backwards, and this poor woman lost her life because of it.
Carol got a restraining order, but in the end, what good was it?
You could blow your nose on a restraining order.
It's no protection whatsoever. It's just a piece of paper.
Every time there was an incident, she logged it with the prosecutor, with the Berlin police.
He actually came here with a pellet gun, blew the windows out of her car.
She had had her bedroom window shut out. The police said that they couldn't prove it was him that did it.
We don't have enough to get him now. Do you have enough?
He actually had a warrant out on him for an infraction against that restraining order. He walked around freely for that whole month. She was the prisoner. My friend might be standing right here today had they arrested him at least on that.
He was a sick man. He had already spent time in prison, so he wasn't abiding by any law.
He tested the waters. He was not reprimanded and had access where he shouldn't have.
And to make it even more tragic, 2 days before this happened to Carol, she went to find out the status of her gun permit.
Yes, she applied April 21st for a gun permit. It was too long to wait to get a gun.
The permitting system is atrocious.
The law says 30 days. It should be issued in 30 days.
And very, very seldomly do we see a permit that's actually issued in less than 30 days from the time it was applied for.
I called the police chief to talk to him about it. I never heard back. From what I understand, the police chief said he wasn't even aware of this law.
It's in black and white in the statute. Ignorance is absolutely no excuse. Every customer that walks through the door complains about our system. What we hear is anywhere from 3 to 6 months is the commonplace, and on a regular basis, 9 months.
Ironically, the worse the neighborhood, the longer it seems to take people to get their permit. I've heard of people waiting for a year and a half in Newark.
What do you say to those people who say, we will never know if a gun would have saved Carol's life?
Who is it for us to decide that? She should have received her permit.
Had he known that she had a gun, he doesn't know that she may not have had it on her. The firearm could have been a deterrent.
At least give them a fighting chance.
For women in a situation like that, there really is no better equalizer than a firearm.
If I had a firearm and I had a 50% chance of saving my life, as opposed to 100% chance of losing my life, I'm all for the firearm.
I'm here at the state capitol where there's already talks from Republican lawmakers plan to push legislation that would speed up the permit approval process for people, quote unquote, protected by a restraining order.
Too late for Carol.
Change is needed more than ever. Gun laws in New Jersey either turn a law-abiding citizen into a criminal or a victim, and they're unacceptable.
They protect the criminal more than they do the victim.
Being the person that Carol was, I know she's very happy for other people that this is coming to light and that we'll be using her name to lead this.
Unfortunately, I think it's going to take a lot more before there's any change, and I think it's going to have to come at the voting booths.
All our Democrats and any anti-gun Republicans all have blood on their hands for this.
Everybody should have a right to protect themselves with a firearm.
Don't punish the law-abiding people by keeping them out of their hands.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Coming to you from CPAC 2016, our on-location sponsor, AdCorps Defense. Title sponsor, Nazar. I feel pretty good because we've kept things generally under control. This is the last segment here of our show, and it's going to be complete
exciting.
Chaos. Complete chaos. We have with us Tony Katz.
Look at that.
host of Tony Katz of the Morning News. Mr. Charles Cook from National Review is our guest co-host. And earlier today, Chris Lash kept saying, why do you never have me on? Like, you know, you have Dana on the program. What am I, chopped liver? So, no.
He's pulling a Chris Christie.
Exactly. Sirloin, buddy.
Sirloin.
Welcome.
The finest.
Welcome. I'm going to call you Salisbury. Salisbury Lash.
Lord Salisbury. Thank
yes,
you.
There you go. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
It's fantastic to be here in between these two esteemed gentlemen.
It's a pretty good place to be right there.
It is
I'm
a
telling
pretty good
you.
Place to be.
So how is CPAC treating you over at the Blaze?
Well, way down there at the Blaze booth.
Right. Miles and miles away.
3 feet away. It's been pretty hectic, you know, like a normal CPAC. But this year, I think when the candidates are already candidates, they get a little more aloof than when they're wanting to be the candidate and they're kind of begging to be on the show. So have you noticed that? Has it been that way for you guys?
They're bitchy. I agree. it's rude and it's inconsiderate. And if Ted Cruz doesn't do all the shows immediately after his speech, I'm voting for Kasich.
I think you just said conservative.
You can hear actually the cheers. Ted Cruz is speaking in the ballroom right now
as
we're talking. You can actually hear the cheers.
Yeah,
that's the first time in 2 days. Actually, I take that back. Yesterday I could hear a little bit, but you know we're a good ways down. But that place is filled up, and you know the passion and the energy here. Obviously, people have their various candidates that they're supporting here, and we've got the race is not decided. But you know it's good to see this. I'll take this over apathy any day.
Depends on who this is from.
I'll take this from everybody.
You know what I mean?
I'll take this energy and this excitement and this passion, even the arguments. I'll take the arguments over apathy.
If they're actual arguments, I totally agree.
Oh, not
fist
fights and not, you know, the stupid snark fest. You know,
right.
Substantive arguments.
Yes.
Like penis size.
Yes.
Substantive. All right. I'm out.
Penis
here.
Size arguments.
You guys want to have that discussion?
No. Well, that's substantive, right? I mean, well, in some cases it is. But maybe not for everybody, okay? Speaking of, John Pop, everybody. Good to see you over there, John Pop. Great job.
Behind the cameras, we're losing control here in front of the camera. We have Kurt Schlichter, who is standing by. Dana Lash is taking pictures of Chris here.
He's no longer standing by.
Ah, good.
Hold on, you got me, guys?
Yeah, we got you.
Oh, man, this is great to be with such renowned people. Cam Edwards,
Charles Cook, Chris Lash,
period.
That was nice. You hear that?
Super exciting.
Yeah, that?
Five Directions,
Charlie and the something's.
Charlie and the Toddler Militia.
That sounds bad.
No, I mean, it sounds like a Mumford and Sons cover band.
It's good to see Kurt Schlichter here because I missed him on the New York Times bestseller list. It's great to see him here.
Who knows the We Are the World? Do we?
Nobody knows the word. Quincy Jones, and it's going to his.
I don't
grave.
Even know the title.
What are you talking about?
I know the Cyndi Lauper verse.
You know that one?
Really?
Wow.
Yeah.
You're not even on a microphone.
Lashes just want to have fun.
I am not going to do the Cyndi Lauper verse, though I do know it because it's very, very shrill. It's much in the same way. It's much like listening to Hillary Clinton give speeches all the time.
Gender fluidity in action. Let's move on.
You got a heck of a show here, Cam.
This is a heck of a show. I mean, this is the segment in which we lose absolute control.
I was just
here.
Taping a special across the studio, so I just wanted to stop in and say hello and just wish you all the best.
He's Don Rickles on the old Carson show. He's going to break the cigarette lighter as well, and then it's going to be a thing.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for coming by. By the way, this guy knows great barbecue in Austin, Texas. Let him be your barbecue guy.
What is your barbecue of choice in Austin?
It is Terry Black's barbecue in Austin.
Nice.
Love that place. Under siege by local authorities because apparently the smell of barbecue smoke is offensive in Austin, Texas. So,
yes,
go check it out.
It irritates hipsters. That doesn't matter.
No, that's just it. It shouldn't irritate hipsters. I mean, that's the whole essence of being in Austin, Texas. But I was just giving Cam tips on good rib barbecue.
Mustard. Put the mustard. I've got a microphone. Yeah. Thank you.
It puts the mustard on the barbecue or else it gets the hose.
Or else it gets the rub again, I believe is right.
All right, so I'm going to go back to my special across the street, across the lot.
Why are you leaving? Did we write you off there? All right,
I don't know. We have limited microphones and you know, something.
I'm really glad I got invited. It's great.
Why are you still here?
That's really good. That's fantastic.
Tony's used to a little more one-on-one time.
He is
a little special time here.
No, what we need is more Andrew Langer. That's the said no one ever, including his wife.
Oh, dear God. It gets worse.
Wow. This is happening.
Oh, there you go.
I heard there was a party over here, and I wanted to just see what was happening. I'm trying to tape a special across the hall here, and it's getting very noisy, and I wish you would all. And who's the one with the British accent that keeps interrupting
everybody?
Tony.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
It's Tony Katz.
I've lost complete and all control.
You've had about 3 minutes to think of a question, and you still haven't managed it.
Here's the thing. Who's the question to right now at this point?
Ask all of us. We'll all answer.
Okay.
What's the question?
Ask the question.
Ask the question.
What is the question?
There's a ratio, people. A ratio.
Here's my question for you. Obviously, you haven't had anything like this chaos on the show, on your show.
On my show?
Yeah, over the last couple
of
years.
It feels good, Larry O'Connor, like it did in the old days. This is actually how Larry worked his way through everything.
Don't talk about the hot tub that stays at home.
You know? Once a Broadway star, always a Broadway star. That's Larry O'Connor, everybody.
Thank you, Larry.
At 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 on WMAL.
That's a lot of hours, isn't it? That's my question for you right there.
What?
Would you want to work that schedule? Would you want to work the split morning drive?
Oh, no. I would never do the split. I'm not that desperate to be famous. But I would add more to what I do. I'd add more to my plate, no question about it. But a split, like what Dana does with radio
TV. You'd add
TV,
more to your plate, Tony?
The amount, hard to believe. The morning and afternoon. Oh, I could do the splits once. Actually, I could do the split. A singular. That is singular. So
no, you would not do that.
Mornings and afternoon radio, that's rough.
Who's been the your favorite guest here on Radio Row over the past couple of days?
That'd be me. I was fantastic on Radio Row today. I was exceptional. There is no one favorite, and mainly that's because no one was very good. I would do anything for some talent to be in this room just freaking once in my life.
You've never asked me to be on your show.
Who?
The talent.
Who, you?
Yes, that's what they call me.
To do what?
To bring talent.
To talk about?
Just general talent.
He's a rapper.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
He works at Target? What do you mean?
Showstopper, like... not a flip-flopper. Come on, that was off the top of my head right there.
It doesn't even make any sense. Listen,
any sense.
You get paid to do this, and that part blows my mind. I could do TV. I'm ready. I'm ready. Sign me up. I'm ready. If this is all I have to do, just bring a bunch of people onto set and let nothing interesting happen, I could do that.
Huh. You'd be great at nothing interesting
happening. Right. You know?
You'd be terrific.
I'd be joyous.
I dare say you already are.
Now, while I talk, you be Chris Christie.
That was a little drop. That was a little Chris Cook.
Enormous.
This is Charles Cook.
Charles, welcome to America. Yeah.
Thank you.
This
welcome.
This is my favorite segment.
This is what it's all about. This is a thing called dignity here.
Charles, just sitting here,
praying for death.
The sweet meteor.
Praying for
it will come take
rocket
us all.
Seat.
Right.
I think it's a nice way to wrap everything up. It's been a really interesting 2 days, and I would say it's actually been a more tense 2 days than people give it credit for. Because I will tell you, we've all done quite a few of these CPACs. I haven't seen a proliferation of T-shirts of candidates and people espousing their candidate. Mm. I haven't seen the buttons. I haven't seen a lot of the cheer. What I'm seeing a lot of are people saying, "What happens next?" There's a tremendous amount against Trump. Well, congratulations. The only guy with a pin is negative. It's all about what happens next. Where are we going? I've heard those conversations, and I think that part is fascinating. At least it means when you talk about no apathy, going back to how you started this conversation before, you know, please notice me, Schlichter showed up. That is true. The apathy isn't there. There is a question of where do we go from here? Will the Republicans be willing to win with Trump? And Charles Cook is not willing. He's not willing to win.
And we might not have the choice. We might not be asked.
We certainly do not have the choice to win with Trump. That's correct.
Well, here's my question, I guess, is we've got about 3 minutes left here on the program. You know, look, I don't think this is an election season that has been like anything that we've gone through before.
No.
And I don't think there's any way, honestly, I don't care how smart you are, I don't care how degreed you are, I don't think that there is any way anybody can honestly predict what's going to happen with the American electorate. Not with the candidates. The candidates are predictable. The American electorate are not predictable right now. That's where I think the big story is. You talk about the people who are here, and they're wondering, where do we go? What happens next? We all should be wondering that. Even the professional commentary should be wondering what happens next. And, you know, sort of this theme that we've had throughout the day today is, when we're talking about reaching out to widen the party's popularity or to widen the movement's popularity, it's less about talking and more about listening, right? When do we start? I'm wondering when the commentariat stops telling everybody else how smart they are and they start listening to the voters around the country. Oh, hi, Seton Miley. How are you, sir? It's good to see you. Actually, would you like a microphone?
My God.
Sure. I have no idea what I'm doing here.
God.
Yeah, that's.
I was directed. I was.
Me too.
Working on something across the hall.
It's like a night at Charlie Sheen's house. People just roll in, roll out, do a line, move on. Dear
wow.
Lord.
Whoa. You know, I.
All right. No one here has done a line. There it is.
Can I have some Ludacris as I roll back out?
Do you know any Ludacris?
Roll out.
Chris
right?
Lash.
Move.
Now that's some rhythm. That's
all right. Now we're really going to class.
Now we're in trouble. Now we're in trouble.
Now we're really going to class up the joint. Ash Gow is with us of the Washington Examiner as well. Hi, Ash. How are you? Let's get a microphone for you.
Here, have a mic.
Wow, you're even tinier than I imagined.
That's what she said.
If I need a ring of power destroyed, I'm calling you.
Wow.
Yeah, I might be corrupted. I'm sorry.
Well, thank you for stopping by as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, so first of all, Tony, you know, is on WIBC. We got Charles on National Review. Kurt, you're everywhere, right? Except Don Lemon's show. And Ash, you're with the Washington Examiner. We've only got like 60 seconds left, but you got to tell us, what are you writing about? Because you are covering college campuses. You are covering not just the freedom of speech, but you are covering due process issues on college campuses.
Now, I mean, this is serious.
Stop it. This is, I think, one of the big... not underreported, well, yeah, a little underreported issues. I mean, you're out there doing it, but it's not like we've got beat reporters from the mainstream media who are covering these issues every day.
No, it's absolutely, and it's frightening because you think if they start taking away these rights on college campuses, then they're going to start coming away for these rights for the rest of us. I mean, they're already trying to take the due process rights away in the mainstream, you know, mainstream law and trying to make these affirmative consent laws the law of the land for the rest of us, which would turn, you know, everybody into a rapist overnight.
Is this so is this something that you're going to be, again, profiling, highlighting, covering throughout the rest of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. It's okay. Pretty much the only thing I write about now.
And you've been covering some crazy stuff, too. But what's interesting is that it seems like we're starting to see some pushback now, right? Some of these
guys Free speech, it's still getting, it's just becoming worse and worse. I mean, there's students who can't even handle the word lynch on a building when it's somebody's last name. They can't handle the Harvard, you know, people who are in charge of the dorms being called house masters because they're too traumatized from, you know, something that happened over a decade, 100 century, a year.
I just want to drop Tony Katz in the middle of the quad at Purdue University. Just set you loose.
Let's
on
go.
These streaking snowflakes.
Let's go.
Well, you know, Cam, we do have an answer to all these problems. It's called our Constitution. How about we go back to that?
Last word, Kurt Schlichter, thank you so much for joining us here from CPAC 2016. Woo. We'll see you soon with more NRA News, Cam and Company.